Let's call to order this meeting, which happens to be a joint meeting of the Senate Energy Utilities Technology and Communications Committee and the House Energy Finance and Policy Division. And Chair Hilty is here from the House also. All the members are here. We're not going to introduce you. You know each other by now. And most of the advocates know everybody here, too. We do have a special presenter here today, who is Casey Golden, Policy Director for Climate Solutions. And we will be here. The focus of our meeting today is to hear about cap and trade from a few different perspectives. But we would like to invite Casey Golden to come up to the table and start a presentation. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Let me just spend a minute getting the technology going. Well, thank you to both chairs and all the members for having me. I am Casey Golden. I'm the Policy Director for Climate Solutions. We are a nonprofit research and advocacy organization from the Northwest states, so we've been working on the Western Climate Initiative. I'm also here at the invitation of the National Caucus of Environmental Legislators. Jane Krentz, the regional coordinator, is here, as is Adam Schaefer, the executive director from D.C. And we've been doing some of these presentations around the country, doing a little cross-fertilization among the different regional climate initiatives. When we first started ours, the Western Climate Initiative, the Northeast states, Reggie, suggested that we just name it after theirs and only put Western in front of it. So they thought that we might call it Wedgie. We actually, for obvious reasons, decided to move on to Western Climate Initiative. And in the meantime, we've been moving very much in parallel with you. And I think we have found it very helpful to be moving forward on parallel paths with different regions, learning from each other, inspiring each other, and moving this ball forward in the regions and ultimately at the national level. So thanks for the opportunity to share this with you. I want to begin, before talking about sort of the nitty-gritty policy design stuff, to just provide a little scope and context, particularly in the light of the current economic situation. Because I think, you know, often when we think about climate as an environmental issue, I was invited to speak to a business audience not long ago, and they titled the presentation and the panel, "Planning for a Carbon-Constrained World, Managing the Business Impacts of Climate Regulation." And I thought, okay, well, it's good that we're starting to plan, but planning for a carbon-constrained world just struck me as a very sort of cramped and pessimistic way to look at what we're starting to do here. And I think it's symptomatic of how we have traditionally and conventionally treated and thought of environmental issues. When we tee up an environmental issue, we often think of it as a matter of constraining or mitigating the adverse impacts of the way the economy functions. Well, that traditional way of thinking about how to address an environmental issue is way too small to address the climate challenge. We can't get where we need to go on an issue like this just by kind of sanding the rough edges off the way that our current energy economy works. We have to, and we have the opportunity to, build a fundamentally stronger and more sustainable energy economy going forward. And that's the only kind of approach that I think will work on an issue like this. This quote from Thomas Friedman I was going to use, I didn't realize that all those great cherry cars would be out on the driveway in front of the rotunda. I might have used a different one. But Tom Friedman has talked a lot about the connection between economic recovery and our climate challenge, and has forcefully made the point that we can't really recover the economy and sustain prosperity over the long haul, just trying to limp along with the existing energy models that we have. Candidate Obama ran on this and featured the new energy economy as a central plank in his economic vision and his economic platform, and President Obama has featured it in his speech to the joint session of Congress as the first and most important plank of his economic vision going forward. And I think that's the context in which we really have to approach this. Now, President Obama, of course, is not the first president to call attention to the dangers of our dependence on fossil fuels. In fact, every president in my lifetime, every president since Eisenhower, has warned against the dangers of fossil fuel dependence. And yet every president has left office with the country more dependent than when they took office. So if this is step one in our 12-step recovery program, it's been a lot of decades of trying to get some real traction on steps 2 through 12. And in the meantime, the symptoms of that dependence, if I sit up like this, can you still hear me okay?
You can also move that. You can move the microphone.
Does it extend?
Just the head of it will direct it up towards you.
Good. In the meantime, the symptoms of that dependence have started to mount in some increasingly uncomfortable ways, starting with the national security symptoms. I was just on the plane over reading Tom Friedman, finally getting to read Tom Friedman's book, and I really highly recommend it, particularly his chapter on the relationship between national security going forward and our dependence on fossil fuels. It really is quite chilling and has become, I think, a central part of our military strategist's thinking and our defense strategy to reduce that dependence as a prerequisite of security going forward. The economic symptoms, and I'm sorry I don't have state-specific numbers here, but in my state, Washington State, our economy lost $16.4 billion just last year to bring in fossil fuels. Now, we're struggling. Our state's about the same size as yours, pretty close to the same per capita gasoline consumption. We don't use as much coal in our power system, but most of this expenditure, of course, is oil and a fair chunk on gas. Our legislature is now wrestling with a $9 billion, or just finished wrestling with a $9 billion biennial deficit, and yet our economy loses four times that much every year on an annual basis just to pay for our fossil fuel dependence. And that's money that goes straight out of the bottom of our economy, creating no jobs, no secondary economic activity, just immediate and total loss to our economy. Very difficult to imagine how you refill our economic bucket, if you will, with a hole that big in the bottom, and how you engineer a lasting prosperity going forward when our economy is draining so much of its resources to support our fossil fuel dependence. And then, of course, the climate symptoms, and I'm not going to do a big science presentation here. I always hesitate to dwell too much on the inconvenient truth, because I always worry a little bit that people might want to get up and decide to go to the other movie instead. But you all, of course, have seen presentations, I'm sure, about climate and its effects on Minnesota. Just to briefly talk a bit about where we are in the timing of all this, because it truly is getting late scientifically in the game. This is the New York Times from 1956, talking about the connection that they were starting to discover between greenhouse gases and warming. If you see in the lower left-hand corner there, they're talking about a theory that was held a half a century before that. By 1988, Jim Hansen, our preeminent climate scientist, had gone before Congress to say that, indeed, the data were in. It was a real problem. Much of it was human-caused, and we needed to do something about it. 1988 was before my kids were born. My daughter will graduate high school this year and go to college next year, if all goes according to plan, and we still have no meaningful national climate policy. Now, I work for Climate Solutions. My kids are starting to wonder whether, in fact, I do go to work in the morning or whether I go play golf. This has been really a very long haul getting started on this. And unfortunately, had we started earlier, we'd have more time to experiment and more time to be incremental. But at this point, we really need to get moving with solutions. I'm sure you're familiar with this prayer from the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr. Madam Chair, I understand you're a clinical psychologist, and I'll let you render the ultimate diagnosis. But from my perspective, the psychology of our collective response to this issue has been dominated a little bit too much by the first part of the prayer and not enough by the second two parts. I want to just briefly look at that question of the wisdom to know the difference, because I think we always struggle when we start to implement solutions to this problem with how much can we do, how much are we really in control of solutions. And this will be my final piece of science, but if you've ever seen a climate presentation, you've probably seen some version of this graph. It's basically the projected temperature increase over this century from the IPCC, and the six or seven different lines there are different international models projecting that temperature increase. And what I want to call your attention to is that the difference between the models are not differences in conclusions about how the atmosphere will respond over time to our inputs of greenhouse gases. There are differences in our inputs of greenhouse gases. There are differences in assumptions about how we develop, what kind of energy choices we make, what kind of technological choices we make. So from the perspective of a climate modeler, those are different scenarios or different assumptions. But from the perspective of a legislator, those are different plans. They're different choices. Now, these are obviously global graphs, but we all face those same set of choices about how we're going to develop, what our energy economy is going to look like, and how quickly we'll reduce our dependence on fossil fuels. And I just want to reinforce that point because people sometimes look at this and say, wow, big range of uncertainty. I guess the jury's still out scientifically. The uncertainty is about the choices we make and what kind of development patterns we have and how quickly we navigate this transition from the fossil fuel era to the clean energy era. And the good news is those are choices that you of all folks are in a really good position to influence. The one other thing the scientists tell us pretty clearly is we don't have any more time to delay making those choices. The accepted sort of international threshold among the scientists for how far is too far to go with global warming is about 2 degrees centigrade increase over pre-industrial levels. Now, there's no, obviously, in the real scientific world, there's no firm line in the sand. But that's the point at which they say the probability of catastrophic, uncontrollable climate changes beyond our ability to adapt starts to get very, very high. So that 2 degree line.
Mr. Golden. Senator Jungbar has a question. Is it okay if we interrupt you to take questions?
Sure.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I kind of want to set the pace here. If we're going to listen to this as though it's accurate information, which it's not, then are we able to challenge each potential graph and chart that comes up? Because, as you know, I do study the science on a daily basis, and I do know the inputs, and I do know that these charts are based on positive feedbacks, which aren't seen in nature, and I guess, and they already said about Jim Hansen being the preeminent climate scientist who's not allowed to, by the way, put anything into the IPCC reports because other climate scientists think his modeling is so out of whack that it's not allowed to be put in there. So do we need to sit here, and since I'd already contacted the CA to see if we could have somebody else to present the other side because I was worried that we'd start out with this kind of stuff, are we able to go back and forth on each item that's presented here, or are we supposed
to
sit through this?
I'm not sure that would be helpful at this point, but we will give you some time to present at the end.
And I would encourage you to hear more from the scientists as well. This will be the end of the scientific portion of the program. And, you know, my main point is that I think most of us, even those of us who disagree on climate science, are coming around to the conclusion that fossil fuel dependence is a dead-end street. And for economic reasons and security reasons and others, it's time to turn that corner. My only point here is that it's not too late, but it's definitely not too early. And from the perspective of avoiding those really high probabilities of catastrophic impacts, the only choice left to us is the strongest and most ambitious and enthusiastic transition from fossil fuels to clean energy.
Okay.
And that's all for the science.
Representative Beard, do you have a question?
Just two brief comments, actually, Madam Chair. Thank you. Mr. Golden, you had the newspaper clipping from the 1950s. I think I've seen that one before. And if the next time you give this presentation, would you show the whole clipping?
Sure.
Because I believe the premise that the scientists in that day were coming from, just having coming off a rather cold and disruptive series, you know, hot 30s, cold 40s, was that they think they figured out how we could make the climate warmer, and they saw that as a good thing. The problem was they ran into about 20 years of cooling in there. So by the time I got in high school, of course, we were all in a panic because it was cooling again. So that would be one thing. What was my second thought? Oh, yes, this chart that you have right here starts in about 1990. We now have about 18 years of temperature, actual temperature records in several areas around the globe. I have seen a rather fascinating chart that actually shows 18 years of what actually happened is opposed to what these climate models were predicting, and it's actually quite a telling chart. That would be a fun one for you to put into your presentation as well. So thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. Senator Jungbar, I'm not sure. I mean, you may want to challenge the presenter, but I would like to hear his position first.
I want to, well, I think you should know his position. That's why he's here.
Mm-hmm.
I think we know that.
Actually, I'm interested in hearing what he has to say.
I just want to point out to everybody that's looking at this chart, too, all these models are based on positive feedbacks, and the positive feedbacks are the only way you can gain that kind of a temperature change. All satellite data that we have today reflects that these positive feedbacks do not exist in nature. All the feedbacks are actually negative feedbacks, which temperate the modeling, which is not in the modeling. So the way the models are based is not how the Earth actually reacts.
I think that the science is showing more and more today, and there are less and less scientists that more and more scientists are agreeing that climate change is occurring and that we are having a problem with global warming. I think there are fewer scientists now that are on the opposite side of that. Now, I preface that by saying that Senator Jugbar is a student in climate studies, and so he does have a fair amount of knowledge, and he's continuing to go to school at this time about this. He's in a master's program, I believe. So he does have a perspective that we must respect also.
Thank you, and I do urge you to hear more from the very best scientists on this. I'm not a professional scientist either, and my main point today is policy design. So there we are with our symptoms from the fossil fuel addiction. What are we going to do about this problem? Well, when gas prices are high, the kinds of prescriptions that we tend to hear sometimes from our leaders are prescriptions like a gas tax holiday. In the context of an addiction, that amounts to cheaper drugs. We heard this from presidential candidates of both parties during the last election, and it was very interesting to hear the electorate's response. We did not hear it from the candidate who won, and in general, most of the response from the electorate seemed to be recognition of this for what it was, which was a campaign gimmick. And I think the response was mostly, we don't want a campaign lollipop. We actually want solutions to this. I take that as a very encouraging sign, frankly, that people are ready to rethink this addiction. More drilling and mining could potentially provide some near-term relief on fossil fuel prices, but it obviously is not an effective solution for a long-term addiction. When gas prices are low, the kind of prescription we tend to hear is this, and that's the situation to some extent now. And I think we've been through a couple of cycles of having some very painful results from our fossil fuel addiction, having those results abate and taking our eye off the ball. And that, of course, has not been an effective way to treat an addiction either. Ultimately, the only effective way to treat an addiction is to steadily reduce dependence. And I really want to emphasize the point that reducing dependence in this case is not primarily about tying a knot in the fossil fuel economy. It's by building a new energy economy that delivers better results, that delivers sustainable prosperity for the long haul. And that's the enterprise that we really need to set ourselves to, and the context in which we take up the question of what does cap and trade policy look like, what does climate policy look like. It's not just a matter of reducing our carbon footprint. It's a matter of setting the stage for a dynamic economic transition from fossil fuels to something better. And we believe the foundation, the policy foundation for that transition, the strongest possible policy foundation, is the cap on carbon. The cap, after 50 years now of speeches and mostly empty rhetoric about doing something about fossil fuel dependence, represents a real policy commitment to get the job done on a certain time schedule with real accountability for results. So it's not by any means the whole policy solution. It's not a silver bullet. There's many things to do to make this transition real. But what a cap does is says we're in. We're going to solve the problem. We're going to solve the whole problem. And it commits us to that result. That's an essential foundation under all the other policy and private initiatives that need to take place in order to effectuate this transition. It's also the strongest possible platform for sending private incentives to build that clean energy economy. And I want to describe now how that works a little bit in the context of your state climate action plan from your advisory group. This is taken out of their report from the climate advisory group. The upward sloping blue line is sort of the business as usual emissions line. And then all the lines below it are the emission reductions that are projected to be achieved by the things that you've already set in motion. Your biofuels initiatives, your renewable electricity, your energy efficiency, your commercial building codes. You've taken some really significant bites out of that upward trajectory already, to the point where you've almost, if you fully implement those, almost flattened your emission trajectory already. So that's a lot of significant progress. Your Next Generation Energy Act targets are the black line in the lower right. So there's still quite a ways to go beyond the policy initiatives you've already undertaken. Your climate advisory group has offered a set of recommendations that I think track pretty closely to the achievement of those Next Generation Energy Act targets. But the question is, what is really going to make those things happen out in the real world? I've been on many of these climate advisory groups myself, and we have developed long lists of stakeholder recommendations in a number of states. But the fact that stakeholders sit around and develop good lists and recommendations doesn't actually make them happen. And actually, the fact that legislators embrace them doesn't always make them happen. They happen or don't because of the economic incentives in the real world to make them happen or to continue to prolong and expand our fossil fuel use. And the single biggest thing we can do to change that investment climate is make the cap real. We convened a group in Washington of investors and businesses and technology innovators and showed them some of our draft recommendations, showed them kind of a graph like this for Washington State and said, what would it take to really get you motivated to be part of the solution, to fill up that space, to develop new solutions we haven't heard of yet? And they said, well, you know, your target is great. It's nice to have a target, but I can't take a target to the bank. I can't finance off a target. If you're serious about this commitment, then make a partnership with the people in the private sector who need to deliver on it and reinforce that commitment with the force of law so that we can go out there and innovate, knowing that there will be rewards for the people who successfully deliver on the achievement of that goal. You don't need to pick the winners. As you know, advocates, you legislators don't necessarily need to pick all the winners and specify, you know, each piece of that space. But if we want the private sector to innovate and invest and develop and accelerate those solutions, they need a strong public policy commitment, and that's what the cap does. I, in a previous life, ran the energy programs for the state of Washington. And when I did that, we were spending about $1 million a month on all state energy programs. We spend about $1 billion a month to import petroleum in Washington state, 1,000 times more than our state energy programs. So the public investments we make are important, and they can help. But we cannot achieve goals this ambitious by swimming against the tide of the economy. We can't do it even with ambitious public investments like the Federal Recovery Act. That's an unprecedented amount of public money flowing into new energy ideas. We calculated about $90 billion of the total recovery package is roughly things that would help you achieve these goals. But $90 billion is only a tenth of what we spend from our pockets to our utilities, into our gas tank, and through the private energy economy every year. So providing a strong public policy foundation that encourages that money to shift from the problem to the solutions is a key underpinning, a key piece of the foundation for all our policy initiatives and all our private initiatives going forward, and that's why the cap's so important. This also is from your report, and maybe I don't know if you've seen a presentation on this report already, but these are some of the recommendations in the report aligned on a cost curve. So the downward pointing ones on the left are recommendations in that report for achieving those reductions that are actually money savers. The ones on the right are ones that have a net cost associated with them. And when you add them all together, the cost of implementing the plan is net negative. There are net cost savings associated with the implementation of the plan. And again, that's that $16 billion in our state, something comparable in yours. Instead of flowing out of the bottom of your state's economy, those items on the left are bringing those energy dollars back into your local economy where they create more jobs in the energy sector, where they create more jobs just because they're in consumers' pockets, getting spent on other stuff besides being wasted on fossil fuels and energy imports. So the economics of this are very positive. In states as a whole, these are all the states that have climate plans. The Center for Climate Strategies analyzed those plans and helped develop many of them and found very substantial cumulative net savings from the implementation of those climate plans all over the country. So the idea that we can't afford to do this in tough economic times sort of cuts against the grain of the economics of fossil fuel dependence. These are things that by accelerating these activities, we're also clearly providing significant economic savings and providing the foundation for investment in new businesses that will create new jobs. So with that as a sort of foundation, I wanted to now go to the climate policy design question, some of which I know you've begun to wrestle with. These are sort of what we use as shorthand for the principles that ought to inform our climate policy design. And I want to talk just for one slide about each principle and then talk about some of the big controversial policy design questions through the lens of each principle to see where we come out. So in terms of effectiveness, I think it's very important, again, to recognize that this is not a job that you can do just by clipping and sanding and shaving the emissions profile of our current energy economy. We really do have to build something that performs much better and delivers sustainable prosperity for the long haul. And that's that scope of the challenge, I think, is very important for developing an effective policy. It can't just be about mitigating impacts. It has to be about setting the stage for accelerated investment in new economic models. Efficiency is critically important. We don't really have time or money for a vastly complicated and inefficient climate policy structure. Some of the things that help us achieve that efficiency are keeping the policy design as simple as possible. It's not going to be, you know, you won't be able to do it on one napkin. There are some inherent complexities here, but there's a lot of policy design choices where you have the opportunity to make the policy inherently simpler and therefore more efficient. We need to invoke the power of the marketplace. This is a picture of the Pike Place Market in Seattle. Again, because the public money that we have available for this is dwarfed by the private money that flows through our energy economy now, capturing the dynamism and the investment potential of the private marketplace is essential to getting the level of investment and the speed of transition that we need here. And finally, energy efficiency itself as a centerpiece of the platform. Our climate policy needs to deliver the strongest possible incentives to waste less. As you notice, most of those items, you probably couldn't tell exactly what those items on the left-hand side, the negative cost items in your plan are, but almost all of them are energy efficiency items because by wasting less, we're saving money as well as reducing emissions. Equity, our third principle. People often ask me, well, you know, Minnesota could reduce its emissions to zero and we'd still be swamped by China and India and still experience all the impacts. Well, China and India do not aspire to become giant polluters. They aspire to become prosperous, to a level of material well-being comparable to ours. And many people all over the world share that aspiration. We can't very well tell those people, sorry, the atmosphere is already full of the emissions that created our prosperity, so there's no room for your emissions. We can't pull up the drawbridge on our current economic model and expect that to result in a global climate treaty that will actually work. And if we don't have that, then our local efforts are fruitless. So we can't pull up the drawbridge, but we can and must build a bridge to a new, more sustainable prosperity, a prosperity that can work for our kids and for the many people in the world who aspire to our level of prosperity. And I would argue that we, having enjoyed so much of the world's prosperity and engineered the best models for prosperity in the world using fossil fuels, have a special responsibility to start and lead the building of that bridge. That will also be the best thing for our economy in the long run, because then we will be the creators and exporters of the technology of the future rather than just the purchasers. Domestically, we obviously, and I'm sure you've heard it in this hearing room, have a lot of equity issues to consider among regions of the country, I'm sure among states within your region, among different industrial classes and income groups. This equity imperative is central. It's central because it's right, because designing a climate policy could have significant equity impacts, and it's the right thing to do to address those impacts. But it's also central because it's, as a matter of practical politics, it's necessary. If we don't address equity impacts, if we don't design an equitable climate policy that allows for continued and broadly shared prosperity, then politically it just isn't going to happen. So equity has to be up front and center in the design of the policy. So now I'm just going to spend a few minutes looking at some of the key design issues through that lens of those three E's and give you a sense of where we come out, not pretending for a minute to be an unbiased source. We have opinions about these design issues, and we'll share them freely here, but I want to ground them on those three principles. First of all, we often hear the debate between the two, you know, major pathways of climate policy framed this way, and I think it's an unfortunate and inaccurate way to do it. Cap and trade and carbon tax are not necessarily alternatives to one another. Carbon tax is a pricing mechanism. A cap is a limit on the quantity of carbon. And so they don't necessarily perform the same function, although they overlap to some extent. Cap and trade is also not one word. I think it's unfortunate in some ways that the public debate about this issue is about cap and trade as a policy design mechanism instead of the fundamental policy commitment behind it, which is represented primarily by the cap. So I want to back up for just a little bit from the way we've thought of the policy design crossroads and emphasize what the point of the exercise is. Our problem here is not fundamentally a price problem. The atmosphere's problem is a quantity problem. It's about how much emissions is up there. Now, price is obviously very much related to that and very central to your thinking about how to design a transition. But the quantity is ultimately what we're after. And that quantity objective, that public policy imperative to have responsible limits on global warming pollution and to reduce our fossil fuel dependence, that's represented by the cap. That is the first essential policy choice. And until we cross that threshold, then the rest of the policy design questions are a little bit academic. Once we do cross that threshold of a commitment to reduce our fossil fuel dependence, then all the policy design questions become very important. Do you want emission permits to be tradable? Do you want the economic efficiencies that come from tradable permits? And if you do, how will you make sure that that market is fair and not manipulated? Do you want the price certainty that comes with a tax? That could be part of the design as well. Standards, incentives, investments, many of which you've already done in this state and proved their effectiveness, can all be part of that program for delivering on the fundamental commitment that's in the cap and aligning economic incentives with the achievement of that cap so that you do it as efficiently and effectively as possible. So two of the kind of high-profile design issues, I know there are many more, and I won't take the time to go through them all, but two of the ones that I'm sure have already generated a lot of controversy in your community and this committee. First, starting with permit allocation. If you have a real cap, you got to decide how to divide up permits to emit that much. And there are more variations within these, but these are the two basic choices. And I think there are very strong public policy reasons to prefer the auctioning of permits. And again, with respect to our three E's, from an effectiveness perspective, if you are giving away permits, then inevitably will face an awful lot of pressure to have that process of giving away permits reward the people with the most political influence, the people with the best lobbyists, when what you need to be rewarding is the people with the best emission profile. Auctioning is the way to make sure that you're allocating this limited public resource on a performance basis and in line with the performance that you're seeking, which is reducing the quantity of emissions. It also allows you to capture the public value of this resource. The sky is inherently a public resource, and the use of its value and the value that's derived from it should be returned to the public in one form or another. There's a lot of interesting ideas. I see you have a report on governance, on allowance allocation, about how to return that value to the public, whether you fund investments in accelerating the transition, whether you provide it directly to consumers as consumer relief. Those are all good debates and choices, but the fundamental underlying principle is it is a public resource and the value should be returned to the public, and the auction is the way to capture that value. From an efficiency perspective, auctioning is vastly simpler. Any other system requires you to make lots of complicated and difficult judgments that are partly scientific and partly political about what did people emit in the past and did they take early action and what should be grandfathered, and all those judgment calls are made much simpler by simply having everybody line up at the same auction. And finally, as Europe found out, giving away permits can result in windfall profits because you are giving away the value of a public resource, and that is in fact what happened in Europe. And it also provides an unfair advantage, frankly, to incumbents, to people who already have their share of the emissions, at the expense of competitors and innovators who also might have good ways to deliver solutions. The second and final design issue I wanted to touch on is offsets. We feel that it's very important to limit the role of offsets and make sure that you get what you're paying for. And if you don't, there is a really serious risk of undermining the effectiveness of the policy. From an effectiveness perspective, you know, again, if this was, if all we needed was 10% emission reductions to solve climate change, then it wouldn't matter where you got them from. You could just pick the low-hanging fruit and not worry about it. But to get to the deep emission reductions we need to stabilize the climate, we need to transform energy technology in the energy-producing sectors. And if all we do is move the pea under the shell and buy some trees or store carbon in the near term, we're not making those technology investments that we need to get where we need to be in 30 or 40 years. I also want to emphasize that storing carbon in trees and soils is a good thing to do, and we should find public policy ways to promote that. We need to store more of the atmospheric carbon in biomass. But it's not equivalent to releasing the carbon that's been stored in the Earth's crust for hundreds of millions of years. It's just not the same trade-off. We need both of those to happen. We should find ways to incentivize and promote both, but where we run into trouble is where we accept temporary storage of biomass carbon as compensation for continuing to release fossil carbon that's been stored for hundreds of millions of years. It's not good compensation. The good news is we need them both. So let's figure out policy mechanisms that genuinely deliver both rather than pitting the two against each other in a zero-sum game as offsets do. Verifying offsets, actually knowing what you got is real and well-verified and reliable, is very hard to do and expensive. There's a trade-off between getting good offsets and getting cheap offsets. And so that inherently adds to the complexity of the program. And from an equity perspective, there is a real concern about continuing emissions and co-pollutants in some places and sort of paying for it, if you will, by making investments in other countries that don't reduce pollution in those communities. And in some ways, it's a real intergenerational equity issue. You know, if we say, let's pick all the low-hanging fruit first, that would be fine if all we needed was low-hanging fruit, but we need all the fruit on the tree. And if all we do now is pick low-hanging fruit, we're basically saying to our kids, you get up there on the high shaky ladder and get the high stuff because we only have the appetite for getting the easy stuff. Cap and trade is obviously not an untried model. You're probably familiar with this, but it's been very successful in reducing the pollution that causes acid rain at a very affordable cost, much lower than was projected by either industry or government or environmental agencies when the program first started, and is an unqualified success story, I think, in reducing pollutants under the Clean Air Act. So what are the concerns, some of the concerns that we typically hear raised, and I'm sure you've heard them, so I want to address just a few off the top. Did it work in Europe? Did it fail in Europe? What happened in Europe? Europe had an explicitly experimental period, and it was 2006, 2007 with their emission trading market, and they made two significant mistakes. They allocated too many permits, and they gave them away. And that resulted in windfall profits. It also resulted in not very much emission reduction. I think it's fair to expect that we're not going to get this 100% right for the first time around the block. Europe, after that trial period, has made the adjustments to tighten their cap, auction more of their permits, and they are now on track in the new compliance period toward their Kyoto goals. Will there be more bumps in the road? I'm sure there will, any place where this is tried, and I think we have to anticipate a certain amount of trying it and correcting errors as we go, and Europe is doing that now. What about manipulation of a market? Are we going to create a big new derivatives market, a big opportunity for market manipulation? That is why we emphasize policy design that's simple in the first place. The more simply the more you make the choice for simplicity in those basic policy design choices, the more you have a policy that's inherently resilient against market manipulation and market abuse. Let's not kid ourselves. We're going to need regulation of this market like other markets do. We've had terrible market abuses in the banks and the mortgage industry. That doesn't mean we're not going to have banks and mortgages. It means that we're going to rethink how we regulate those markets, make them inherently simpler, and regulate them better. And I think the same applies here. There are also a lot of choices you can make, trade-offs to reduce the amount of trading that takes place and reduce the potential for market manipulation. Maybe a trade-off to some extent for against efficiency, but it might really be worth doing to limit who can participate in the market, limit the conditions under which permits are tradable. All those are fair and important policy design debates to have. And how will it affect lower-income households? First of all, I think it's important to recognize that the problem very disproportionately affects lower-income folks, both in the U.S. and around the world. Fossil fuel dependence is a real economic problem for people in lower income brackets. Climate change itself is a real economic problem for the people who can't afford to move to higher ground when the water comes up and can't afford good medical care when disease spreads, can't afford good shelter and food on a good day, let alone on a Katrina kind of day. And those kind of events are one of the anticipated effects of global warming. No one event can be attributed to global warming, but the increasing pattern of extreme weather events and its effect on the poor globally and domestically is very significant. But the policy itself also needs to be designed clearly with an eye toward its impact on the people who can least afford it. And the cruel irony of all this, of course, is the people who contribute the least to the problem suffer the worst of the effects. So we really owe it to ourselves and to them not to aggravate that with policy design. It's very important to mitigate price impacts. I think that should be among your very highest priorities for what you do with auction revenue. And at least as importantly, we're not just trying to walk away from the fossil fuel economy. We're trying to walk toward something better. And particularly for people with limited economic choices, it's critically important that we accelerate our efforts to provide affordable, practical choices for the people who can least afford price increases. And that's going to be an important part of the policy design as well. That's why many of the reasons that so many of the complementary policies moving forward along with the climate policy is such an important imperative. And then the big question on everybody's mind and that you hear a lot about is what about fossil fuel prices? Is this going to raise fossil fuel prices? Can the economy handle that? I think it's very important, again, to go back to our goal about reducing fossil fuel dependence. The point
Excuse me just a minute. Representative Westrom has a question.
Madam Chair, to this point, you said it's the ones that are harmed the worst are the ones that can least afford it. I inferred from that you're saying, I mean, the poor class would be the ones you're inferring about. But aren't they also the ones that benefit from low energy costs and low input costs for making products that they have to buy and consume to heat their house and light their house? How do you square those two things? I mean, it seems to me you add cost to energy and the poor are going to be hurt worse than those that can afford it.
Right. Very fair point. I'm actually going to address it a little bit in this slide, but let me just directly engage that a bit. When you look at those three big symptoms of fossil fuel addiction, the poor pay disproportionately for all three of those symptoms. They are also the people who can afford the least mobility. So when we don't invest in public transportation systems, when we don't invest in weatherization and energy efficiency, they're the people who suffer the most from that as well. Now, if prolonging fossil fuel dependence would serve the interests of the poor and the middle class, if that was a good economic strategy, then you would rightly ask, well, you know, maybe we shouldn't address climate change because a lot of people can't afford it. But what I'm trying to do here is make the case that prolonging fossil fuel dependence is a very bad economic strategy for the poor and the middle class and all of us alike. And accelerating our transition away from fossil fuel dependence ultimately lowers the cost of energy. Keep in mind that when we pay fossil fuel prices, fossil fuels are very costly now. Even when gas prices are low, we pay for fossil fuels in military protection of our fossil fuel supplies. The poor are very strongly disproportionately represented in our national defense. We pay for fossil fuel dependence in what's happening to our climate, and the impacts of that fall disproportionately on the poor. So these costs, just because they're not in the price of fossil fuels, doesn't mean we don't pay them. We pay them in our taxes. We pay them in national defense. We pay them in what's happening to our agricultural and water systems. And the poor pay more than most as a proportion of their income. So fair point, if you raise the price of fossil fuels, you really need to think about what the effect is on the poor. But I'm saying that point works in both directions because the problem also disproportionately impacts the poor. So in thinking about exactly this point, remember the in the near term, climate policy in a market economy will raise the price of fossil fuels. It will not necessarily raise the price of energy, and it will almost certainly not raise the cost of energy overall. Because remember what this is about. It's not about raising fossil fuel prices and then sitting there in the middle of the road and watching the truck run us over. The objective is not pay higher fossil fuel prices. It's do something different. It's engineered different alternatives for people. It's accelerating the transition so that precisely so that we don't have to pay the high cost of fossil fuels, both the price at the pump and the high cost that we pay in these other currencies, in national defense and in the environmental impacts. So, you know, whether you have a good strategy for accelerating that transition away from fossil fuels will ultimately be the measure of how low income and every other consumer is affected by this. So fossil fuel prices skyrocketed that last summer, plummeted this fall, and there is no climate policy. So what's causing that? Economics is causing that. Supply and demand largely is causing that. And as soon as the economy begins to recover and demand begins to recover, you can expect tight fossil fuel supplies to deliver the same kind of result on prices. So supply and demand is the governing factor. It's not the only thing. There is one other factor. The people who have the most control over fossil fuel price and supply are the people who have the greatest incentive to encourage investment in alternatives. Now, I'm not saying they're bad people. I'm just saying that's their market position. What they do is sell fossil fuels, so they don't particularly want us to invest in alternatives. And it's happened before. When investment accelerates, prices come down, in part to knock the foundation under out from under the alternatives and prevent the transition away from fossil fuels, because fossil fuels is their business. So where's our leverage in this? We control maybe 3% of the world's oil supplies. We can drill all of them. But we have maybe 30% of the world's oil consumption. Our leverage in that supply-demand equation is on the demand side. The best way for us to have an effect on fossil fuel prices going forward is to use our leverage as huge consumers to make the transition and reduce demand. So what really drives the opposition to this policy from fossil fuel suppliers? They say a lot about fossil fuel price increases. I will just say it's not obvious on its face that fossil fuel price increases are a bad thing if you're a fossil fuel supplier, and I think their economic performance in 2008 is testimony to that. So what really drives their opposition? What drives their opposition is the same reason that it'll be good for consumers, good for the environment, and good for the economy, and that is that it will systematically reduce our consumption of fossil fuels. Now, if your business is selling fossil fuels, that may not be good news, but for the rest of us, that is really our only hope of changing this economic dynamic where we are quite literally over a barrel to the fossil fuel economy and giving everyone in our economy the opportunity to have affordable alternatives to continuing to pay that high cost. Why should states continue to do this, particularly now that the federal government is taking up the cause? First of all, as you well know, global warming is a bit of a misnomer. It describes the trend in the global average temperature, but as I'm sure you would agree, the trend in the global average temperature is a modeling result. Nobody lives in the global average temperature. When you think concretely about how we cause the problem, how we experience the impacts, and most of all, how we roll up our sleeves and begin to implement solutions, so many of the answers are state and local and regional. So many of the answers are in our hands in this room. I don't mean to say for a minute we don't need a national and international climate policy. We absolutely do. But this is where the rubber hits the road and where a lot of the action needs to take place, even after we have a national climate policy. My legislators asked me this year in Washington State, and I told them that President Obama did not say, yes, I can, so you don't have to. There is now finally the beginning of a national effort to create a climate policy. I really don't think that state leaders should stop leading in anticipation of that. If we're passing a baton here on some of this, it's very important for the passer to keep running until there's a firm grip on the other end. But it's also very important from the perspective of our own local economies. The best way to ensure that there will be strong national action is to keep acting ourselves. That is our best leverage. That is in many ways why the federal government's now taking it up, is because you have paved the way and begun to lead already. The best way to position for national action is to act ourselves. I noticed the Reggie governors recently sent a letter to Congressman Waxman and Markey talking about wanting, you know, to make sure that they protect the auction revenues that are already built into their auction system. I know in the WCI, our state folks are already talking to the committee about this as well. Some of these design issues will happen on the federal level as well, But getting our oar in the water with our own actions is one of the best ways to protect the unique interests of our state's economies. And then after they act, the game's not over. You are still the ones that make it real. And so it's important for you to have an active role in designing and shaping the policy, not just receiving what comes down from the feds. As they say, you know, you can send your lobbyists to D.C., but the best way to really be at the table for national climate policy design is to keep moving forward and to keep being an active part of designing that policy in your own jurisdictions. That pretty much concludes what I have, and I'd welcome any questions and just leave you with the thought that, you know, I described a little bit about the sort of physical climate timeline and clock that's ticking and how late it is in that game. There's also a diplomatic timeline in that the countries of the world will meet in December in Copenhagen to renegotiate the international agreement. Mm-hmm. It's very important that we come to that table mm-hmm. with both feet having anteed up with a real national climate policy. And, you know, in many ways, state leaders like you are the driving force for these regional initiatives and ultimately for national climate policy. And I think the rest of the world has a right to look to us for leadership in this debate, and they have frankly and honestly been very frustrated with the posture of our federal government in the international debate up until now. In those intervening years, the fact that your states were moving forward is what helped provide hope and momentum to the international effort. The maps, like the one I just had up of the regional climate initiatives, were put up on the wall at the international negotiations as a concrete sign that many parts of the U.S. are actively planning to be part of the solution. And I can tell you that the international agreement would not have gone forward without that sign from state and local leaders like yourselves. So your leadership has been incredibly important up until now, and now is not a good time to stop leading as the federal government takes this up. We got a lot more work to do. So thank you very much, and I welcome any time for conversation or questions.
I'd like to thank you for the presentation. And I know that people do have questions and comments, and Senator Jungbar wants to jump right in.
Well, you know, Madam Chair and members, I will actually try to steer as clear away from the science as I can. Everybody knows how strongly I feel about that, and I really wish we would have an open, both-sided discussion on that for legislators, both at the state level and the national level, because the science that's out there is never fairly treated, I don't believe, in the United States today. But there's a lot that we can agree on, and people in this room know my stand on that, and it does drive me crazy, our energy policy, because I'm 100% and since the 70s have worked on alternative energy projects. So I guess my thought process is if we could set climate aside from the standpoint of if we could move forward on alternative energy issues. Because in order to assume that we're really going to harm the climate, if that science is supposedly right, which I would argue with, we have to assume that we're going to continue for the next 100 years the same thing we've done literally for the last 100 years. We have to assume no new technology, no movement in that direction, and I don't believe that for a minute. As we look back over the last 100 years, things change exponentially all the time. So what do you think is keeping us from becoming the innovators that I think the United States ought to be, and why can't we seem to see the handwriting on the wall? Why can't we see that China is springboarding past us and India is springboarding past us because of our lack of innovation? I mean, that is, I think, where members, where the rubber meets the road. If we were innovating, if we had things that spurred us ahead, we wouldn't be having these conversations in this realm or this line of crisis, if you will, because the technology would just be spurring us in other directions constantly. What's your insight on that you could give us?
That's a great question.
Mr.
Thank
Golden.
You. Thank you very much. We're starting to see some encouraging signs from technology innovators in this country that they're starting to pay attention to and drive money and innovation into the energy sector in a way that they haven't in the past. We started interviewing technology investors and inventors in about 7 years ago and asked them, look what's happening with my cell phone, look what's happening with my computer, why isn't energy moving at the same pace? And they were discouraged by the fact that energy has been a monopoly regulated industry, slow to innovate, not as much of a competitive issue, high barriers to entry, And so they just didn't feel like it was as wide open of a market space for them to innovate in, and that's probably true. Our investment, I'm sorry I don't have the numbers on the top of my head, but our investment in energy R&D as a proportion of our energy expenditures is way out to the right of the decimal point compared to any other sector of the economy. We just have not been putting the money into innovation. So part of that is a function of the fact that energy has been a monopoly industry. A big part of it, though, is public policy. We have the weakest fuel economy standards in the world. The average new Ford gets fewer miles per gallon than the Model T. China's efficiency standards for cars are much stronger than ours. Europe's are twice as strong. Denmark, a country about the size, not pretty similar in size to Minnesota, made a very strong commitment to a strong renewable energy standard, reduced their greenhouse gases by half, and they have captured the dominant share of the world wind technology industry in a very small country. Japan and Germany are way out ahead of us on solar technology, again, because they've made those fundamental policy commitments, part of which involves higher fossil fuel prices in those countries and part of which involves stronger climate policies in those countries. But they have said, we have made the choice at this crossroads. We are not going to stake our economic future on deepening our fossil fuel dependence. We are going to lead those technology sectors that are going to drive the new energy economy. And they've expressed that commitment in their public policy. And when we interviewed technology investors and inventors in this country and asked them just that question, what would it take to capture the best of America's innovators and focus them on this transition so we can be leaders in this space, they said we need that strong public policy commitment that many other countries have. Again, you don't need to tell us what to do. You don't need to pick technology winners. But we need to know that there's a strong public policy commitment to reduce emissions and develop our clean energy sector. I think that's the single biggest factor.
Senator or Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, I had a couple comments that were germane a while ago when Mr. Golden was talking about insisting actually that the poor were going to be the biggest victims of global warming. And I'm going to take exception to the statement because just a casual look back through two millennia seems to indicate otherwise, that when we've had periods when the climate has warmed, that actually population has grown, wealth has increased, lifespans increased, mostly from decreased disease and better food supply. When we've had cold times, that's been hard on everybody, from rich to poor. And I'm thinking here that, just looking at the world today, where most of the people live within about 20 degrees of the equator, we're a little exceptional living up here at 45 degrees. But that's because we've had inexpensive means of keeping our houses warm in the Minnesota winter. So I guess I take exception to and ask to challenge you a bit on the idea that global warming equals bad things for poor people. I think history proves just the opposite. There's a bunch of other stuff I could talk about, too, but, you know, we're on a schedule here, and there's other good people to hear from, so I think I'll withhold the rest of my comments at the moment.
Madam Chair, your discretion on whether you'd like to get more people in. Yeah.
You may comment if you wish, Mr. Golden.
I urge you to look at the studies from the UN Environment Program, from the agencies all over the world that serve the world's poor, but I do think Katrina provides an illustrative example. Hundreds of millions of people live in very close proximity to sea level. And again, no one event can be definitively attributed to global warming, but on every continent over the last 50 years, extreme flooding events like that driven, and it's not rocket science, it's driven by more warmth in the atmosphere, more warmth in the ocean, are becoming 300 to 700% more common. I've got a slide that'll go over that with you if you like. But all I'm simply saying is, in cases of, I think the biggest effects of climate are not going to be the smooth changes like you see coming out of the models, but are the disruptive weather events that are hard to adapt to. And the people who have the least margin, the least room to adapt, the least resources for weathering those kind of storms, and you and I probably aren't them, are the people who are going to have the hardest time dealing with that.
Madam Chair, since you brought up Katrina, I can't resist.
Representative Beard.
What you actually had in Katrina was several hundred thousand people of lower income actually living below sea level thanks to government intervention. It was government monkey business at its best, building on a world-class, they said, storm. I mean, I've been to New Orleans a couple times. It's pretty amazing to watch how it worked. All the pumps and made it possible for people to live where they probably shouldn't have been living in the first place. A Category 3, oh, by the way, that breached government dikes and government dams and wrecked a city. And you're right. I wish you'd stop using that, because whenever I bring up the fact that my raspberries are 3 weeks behind now because we're having another cold spring, it's always insisted that weather doesn't equal climate. But somehow Katrina, a weather event that was a disaster largely because of government programming, is pointed to all the time at being reason why we should believe and accept everything we're hearing about the global warming crisis and its necessarily dire effects. I guess the two don't wash. I'm asking for a little consistency here, and just needed to point that out as soon as you raised the K word. The people lived in New Orleans because the government helped them live there, and we may want to rethink how much government involvement is going to save us from ourselves.
Very fair point. I would say, just back on the science issue, I guess, rather than the issue of government's role, that I want to be absolutely clear in saying you cannot attribute one cold spring or one storm to global warming. What you can do is look at the physics of how greenhouse gases trap heat, the trend in these events over time, the projected trends that our best scientists tell us, and tell us not that Katrina was caused by global warming, but that we are loading the dice for more Katrinas in the future, and that's really the threshold choice.
Okay, Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Golden, my interest in the larger issue is really an economic interest in the and spurring transition in our economy to a lower carbon, more efficient, more local economy. Some of us have been working closely with the Swedes. We have a very strong connection here in Minnesota with Scandinavia. And I think I'd like to just tell you what we've learned and then hear if you have other areas that other places that we should be looking for some success stories. I know there's some liabilities or some things to be learned elsewhere. But in 1990, my understanding is Sweden implemented their carbon policy, in this case a tax. Since then, over the last two decades, their carbon emissions have gone down 9%. Their GDP has increased 48%. And their most available because of their use of their most available resource, that is biomass, woody biomass, increase of 80%. Unless folks think that it's a partisan issue, Michael Woods, the Republican ambassador, Bush appointee to Sweden, looked at his grandchildren and said, you know what, I think that I want to make a difference for them. And his next big thing has spurred a very strong Swedish-American economic relationship. I'm wondering if you know of other economies where a specific market intervention has resulted in that win-win of carbon reduction and GDP growth.
Right.
Mr. Golden.
Thank you. Denmark is another terrific example. Spain has had extraordinary growth in their renewable energy industry. Japan and Germany right now have an enormous competitive edge because they produce a given unit of economic output with half the energy input that we have. As fossil fuel supplies become more constrained and prices go up, that's going to be a real competitive issue. In Minnesota, Sweden is probably a more readily assimilated example. In Washington, we look to California a little bit. And California, in terms of state policies and having a longer history than most other states with really deep investment in energy efficiency, has seen its economy grow tremendously over the last 20 years with no growth in energy consumption. So that's it can happen in the U.S. as well under our laws and our cultures. But you really are seeing an explosion of this kind of innovation in many of our industrial competitors, and there's very few places now as you sort of scan the clean energy technology horizon where the U.S. is in a leadership role. And that's fundamentally because of the lack of the kinds of policy commitments that you've described.
Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first, just a little clarification. I think a lot of what your testimony was, fossil fuel dependence is bad for lower income people, you know, due to the price fluctuations like we've seen and due to the inability to adapt and take on the new technologies in some ways. If we don't have economic incentives to do that, we're sort of at the whim of a market we have almost no control over. So I really appreciate the comments of our leverage is on the demand side, not on the supply side, if you just look at the basic numbers. But, and I'm going to kind of make a statement because we've had differing opinions at the table and just ask that you comment a little bit about it. But looking at dealing with both fossil fuel dependence and climate change and the impacts on the lowest income and the people who have the least ability to adapt due to means or resources, I think we need to remember that history isn't always the most helpful thing to be looking at in this case. We're nearing peak oil. We are, from an ecological perspective, looking at how many people the world can hold and the carrying capacity, so to speak, with how much we use. Looking at the efficiencies humans have said, which is dollar efficiencies, throughput, not really looking at the waste on each side rather than kind of natural efficiencies when Representative Kalin talked about local economies and being efficient from an energy or a local economy perspective rather than just the way our policies and subsidies have held them up. I think we can't only look at history when we're looking at climate. We need to look at the fact that we're in a different world and we're in danger of creating a totally different world. And to make that transition in a way that's as humane as possible, I think, is my priority as a legislator and a leader at the state level and hopefully pushing our federal and international governments in that direction. So I don't know if you care to comment on that, but that's my thoughts looking at this presentation.
Mr. Golden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wish I would have said that. It's very eloquently put. If you, I don't know if how many members of the committee have had an opportunity to look at the work of Van Jones, who has been sort of the popularizer of the idea of green jobs and the idea of building pathways out of poverty in the green economy. He talks about connecting the people who most need work with the work that most needs doing, and the intimate connection between resolutions to climate and resolutions to poverty, both as a moral imperative and, again, as a practical political imperative. But I recommend you to that. He was profiled recently in The New Yorker, and he's now the president's green jobs advisor.
We actually had his presence here about a month ago, and okay. He had an opportunity to speak with
okay.
him.
Okay. Well, the last thing I want to do is try to describe Van, if you've already heard from him. I really think, you know, as I look, and Climate Solutions has wrestled with this as well. We do a lot of work with innovators and people who are pioneering the new energy economy, and we have had to rethink some of that to make darn sure that the new economy that we're describing is sustainable not only in the sense that it can last a long time, not only in the sense that it produces less emissions, not only in the sense that it reduces fossil fuel dependence, but in the sense that it can work for a lot more people around the world and here at home in this economy than the current economy works for. And I don't believe the transition is possible unless we commit ourselves to that goal. But again, I think Van Jones has delivered more good work on that subject than I could ever offer, and I'm glad you got the chance to hear him.
Representative Bly.
Yes, I'm wondering, you mentioned several policies to move in a more renewable
Representative Bly, I know the microphone is not easy for you, but if you could
okay.
perhaps
all right.
move it.
You mentioned policies in other countries that have stimulated innovation and renewable energy market. I'm wondering, some of the countries that you mentioned implemented a feed-in tariff policy. Mm-hmm. Do you have an opinion or any thoughts about that policy?
It's a very powerful policy. Madam Chair, would it behoove us for me to just describe what it is, or has people? Do you think people have a basic?
I think that would be fine for you to describe it.
Just very briefly, it's Germany pioneered it, but the idea is that people who erect their own, particularly solar facilities, can sell electricity back into the grid at a very attractive rate that helps overcome the financing obstacles and helps feed that renewable energy back into the grid. We've discussed it in a few states in the U.S., and I know at least one community, I think in Florida, is now piloting it. And it's a very powerful policy, and it's one that has the attraction of, you know, incentivizing renewable technology development, but also incentivizing the development of a more distributed and flexible and network-like energy system. And I think that more kind of distributed platform, an energy system that is more interactive, more resilient, more flexible, with sources and users connected to each other in multi-directional ways, much like the transition from mainframe computers to an internet. I think that transition is beginning to happen in the electricity sector, particularly now as information technology begins to penetrate into cars and homes and appliances. And I think that's going to be a fundamentally better performing energy economy, less risk, lower cost, lower emissions. And these feed-in tariffs are a great way to send an incentive to start making the network more distributed. There is typically concern among consumer advocates and others about the price that gets paid to feed the electricity back in. So there's a little bit of a negotiation about what are the costs to the whole system. And that depends kind of on what scale you're doing it and how you adjust the prices over time. But it's undoubtedly been a terrific incentive for expanding renewable energy production, decentralizing the grid. Again, I was just reading in Friedman today about how you need sort of two levels of technology acceleration. One is more investment in basic R&D for really breakthrough stuff on material science and, you know, the way photosynthesis works and that kind of thing that we just don't know how to do yet. But a huge part of it is accelerating and taking to scale the stuff that we basically do know how to do already. And if you look at the stabilization wedges analysis that's often used for to help people to kind of see how existing technologies can be applied to the problem, you can get an awful lot of the way there on things we basically know how to do now that we need to deploy at bigger scales so we can work our way down the manufacturing learning curve that led from, you know, Friedman says, think about the cell phone you were carrying 5 years ago and the one you're carrying now. Think about your first computer and the laptop that you have now. Those weren't fundamental breakthroughs that made that difference. They were getting more experience with more manufacturing, more scale that allowed us to make those products much better and cheaper. And I think feed-in tariffs really help with that, particularly for solar. And I do think that among the renewables, those decentralized distributed solar technologies ultimately hold the most potential in the long term. They're not as cost competitive in the near term, so you need some bridging strategies to make the economics work, but they have huge potential in the long run.
Okay. I have Representative Westrum and then Representative Falk and then Senator Rosen. Representative Westrum.
Madam Chair, two points or questions. One, getting to the warming discussion that Representative Beard brought up. So the warming is a bad thing. Representative Beard talks about the warming actually fostering more food, more opportunity, growth, et cetera, et cetera. I live under a glacier, and I'm just wondering, how do you square the hyper-negative consequences that we keep talking about with what if we were here, I don't know how many thousands of years ago or hundreds of years ago, that we would have had to have this discussion to stop the glaciers out in western Minnesota and the Dakotas from melting, creating the Red River Valley and Lake Agassiz and all of that. And I assume that's not a phenomenon just unique to Minnesota and North Dakota. There's other instances in history of that. If warming didn't attribute to that, what would have? And would have we tried to stop those glaciers from melting had we been around to do that?
We had a cold spring, too, and it really creates a messaging problem. I actually had a slide in here at the beginning that replaced this title with Global Warming, Bring It On, We're Ready. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is the sort of most exhaustively sort of researched comprehensive consensus science document we have, and it does document some potentially positive effects. But I think the important thing to think about this is, you know, if we got to create the planet from scratch, we probably could think of a few improvements and places where we would like it better. But we kind of got the planet we got. And then we developed this elaborately adapted and expensive physical and natural infrastructure to live as well as we know how to live on the planet that we've got. So when you throw that all up in the air and say maybe it'll land back down in a better way, it is very disruptive to the systems that we have now. It may not be the ideal planet you would have invented, but it is the planet that we've built the water systems for, built our agricultural systems for, and our civilizations around. And it's very expensive to think about how to re-engineer our systems to a rapidly changing planet. So it's not about so much good or bad. It's about rapid changes end up being very expensive and disruptive to the systems we've built to live well on the planet we have now. I happen to also be kind of sentimentally attached to the way the planet works now. I like the seasons. I like the differences in topography, and you can always move to someplace warmer if you don't like it where it's cold. But it is very hard and expensive to re-engineer natural systems, particularly in the western U.S., our water systems. You know, our economy runs on the water that's stored as snow in the Northwest. We don't have a lot of big storage projects. It's all snow in the mountains. If we had to replace that water storage with dams and water storage projects, even if we thought they were environmentally acceptable, the cost would be astronomical. So it's mainly a matter of the costs and benefits of dramatic change, not whether, you know, a warmer winter in place X might be a little more hospitable.
So, Madam Chair,
Representative Wester.
I mean, if we were around having this discussion and debate when the glaciers were melting that formed Lake Agassiz, would have we tried to stop it?
When those glaciers formed, there are natural processes that over the millennia have pushed us in and out of ice ages. They happen over millennia, over tens of and hundreds of thousands of years. The increase that we're seeing now is happening on a much more quicker time scale and, if you believe the scientists, driven by human activity. None of those things were true that time around. So I guess, you know, part of the issue is, are we causers and fixers or are we just victims in this picture? You know, and I think what the scientists are telling us is you just cannot explain what's happening to the climate and the concentration of these gases in the atmosphere without accounting for the human contribution. So, you know, in that instance, whatever animals existed then, if any did, were victims. They were observers of that phenomenon. We're not observers anymore. We're bigger than that on this planet. We're causers and fixers.
Okay, I have three more that would like to ask questions, and then I think we're going to have to move on. So, Representative Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I wish my friend Representative Beard was still here because his comments spurred a couple of questions that I have, and maybe Mr. Golden, you could speak to them, and also spurred by Representative Westrom's comments, but talking about how the warming may have contributed to population growth or higher levels of utility. Can you speak at all about some of the issues we may face with respect to agriculture, with the greater prevalence of diseases, of pests, of the ability to have to irrigate our croplands, and how that might have some impacts on whether it be the poor or whether it be our civilization way of life in general?
Yeah.
Mr. Golden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Food producing systems are one of the real serious concerns here. I'm not as familiar with your hydrology and your patterns locally. I do know that in this part of the world, you are projected to experience a significant loss of soil moisture in the summer and some disruption to your water supply patterns that might have to turn you toward more irrigated agriculture. You will probably have longer growing seasons. But in every scientific analysis that you can find, they will mention the positive upticks. But again, because we are adapted to the systems we have now, the negative consequences like the ones you describe tend to overwhelm them. We are seeing a northward and higher latitude spread of disease vectors, and both for humans and for pests that affect forest health and agricultural health. I know in the Northwest, if you come visit sometime, the forests, particularly in British Columbia and also east of the Cascades in Washington and Oregon, are just a mess. Vast swaths of those forests are being destroyed now because these pests have spread and because we don't get the cold winter, the deep cold winter kills that used to control them. Now, again, you can say, well, that's good. We don't have – our winters aren't as cold anymore. But, again, our forests and our natural systems and our human systems adapted to the climate we have. And this dramatic change is changing them in some very disruptive and expensive ways.
Thank you. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Golden, you made a comment about California, and we seem to talk a lot about California around this table. And you made the comment there that they've experienced a growth in the economy with no increase in the energy consumption. That's a pretty broad statement.
Electricity sector energy consumption.
And I guess my question, Mr. Golden, would be geared towards job growth, about green jobs, as that growth just naturally, I mean, or is it due to green job growth or what they've done with their energy regulations? Tell me a little bit more about your statement.
I'm not sure I, Madam Chair, can speak to all the drivers for economic growth over time in California. They obviously have a very dynamic economy and multifaceted economy. What I can say, though, is that their commitment to improve energy efficiency and reduce energy consumption has been a part of their economic success story because, again, that flow of dollars out of their economy to import energy has slowed. So two things happen as a result of that. One is some of that money goes to the new energy industries that replace that fossil fuel consumption, the energy efficiency, more efficient buildings, renewable energy, and you're familiar with the list. But the other thing that's even more important to their economy is by wasting less money on fossil fuels, they're leaving more money in consumers' pockets, where it gets spent on clothing and food and the mix of consumer expenditures. Almost all of those expenditures create more jobs and more secondary economic activity than spending money on energy, and particularly spending money on fossil fuels, where most of the money goes straight out of the state. Within the energy sector, a given dollar spent on energy efficiency or renewables will create more jobs than that same dollar spent on conventional fossil fuel or nuclear technologies, and I can give you citations for that. So there's been a very strong synergy between their clean energy commitment and their economic success. They've also found that their leadership on vehicle technology, by being the first state to adopt stronger emission standards, actually created, I'm not going to remember the number, so I'm not going to quote it, but I saw an economic study on the job growth associated with having a public policy that spurred that innovation, and it drew from their existing strengths in aerospace and related technology sectors to create a whole new industry in California, which is not a big car producer, around the technologies that actually make those cars cleaner. So there's been a clear correlation there as well between their commitment to a clean energy transition and the success of their economy over time.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Golden, thank you for the presentation. As I was listening to this now, the kind of the key parts that I was picking up is we need a simple system. We need full participation, and that a cap and trade system is, with that offsets is extremely difficult to implement and would be very expensive. And you talked a little bit about carbon tax. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that to go forward, the way to address all of those factors is a carbon tax. And can we implement a cap and trade system without a carbon tax for any kind of, you know, effectiveness? And is that possible to do this without it being on a national level? Can we do a cap and trade with, say, a carbon tax, if that would be part of it, on a regional level without putting us at a serious economic disadvantage to other regions of either the world or the country?
Right.
Mr. Golden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Starting with your last question, the economic disadvantage, you know, again, that is essentially what Europe has done. In many cases, and they are now taking the leadership role in the development of these clean technology industries. They pay more for their gas. There's no question about it. So again, you know, arguably paying more for fossil fuels in the near term is an economic disadvantage. If it's part of a policy commitment to make a transition and take a leadership role in industries that are going to be fundamentally more competitive and prosperous in the future, it may be an economic cost you want to pay in order to set yourself up for success in the future. On just generally the carbon tax question, having finished my income taxes not long ago, I'm a little dubious about the prospect that a carbon tax is going to be that much simpler. Public policies tend to get complicated and convoluted because the nature of our process has a lot of players and a lot of interests to accommodate and represent, and a lot of people crafting the policy. And that dynamic is going to be true whether you call it a tax or whether you call it a cap and trade. And so I think you have to guard against excessive complexity and loopholes either way. Having said that, one of the disadvantages that people often say about a carbon tax is, well, it's the T word, and we can't do that. It's politically untouchable. I'm not sure, you know, a good climate policy in a market-based economy is going to drive the cost of fossil fuels higher, and that's a politically difficult fact, no matter what you call it. So I'm not sure doing cap and trade is, and of course, the opponents call the president's cap and trade proposal the president's energy tax proposal. So either way, working through that politics of the potential for near-term increases on fossil fuel, price increases on fossil fuels, and how that sets you up to make an economic transition and reduce your dependence on fossil fuels, those politics are complicated, and I think they're complicated either way. The final thing I would say about a carbon tax, and I do think there may be some appropriate applications for it, is it is a pricing mechanism. We need a public policy commitment to responsibly reduce this pollution and reduce our fossil fuel dependence. Carbon pricing is a tool in the toolkit that can help us achieve that commitment, but it doesn't substitute for the commitment. So even if you think it's an attractive tool, and I think there's a lot to be said for it, I still think you need a cap. You need a public policy commitment to actually get the job done. And if you think about how would you set a tax? Well, you'd set it because you're trying to induce a price effect that would change the quantity that might. Well, you're still thinking about the quantity. The quantity is still your objective. And what I'm, I guess, proposing is that the quantity needs to be your leadership commitment and your legal commitment. And a tax within that framework may be effective, but it's not an alternative to that commitment.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Golden. We really appreciate the time that you've spent with us and your presentation.
I appreciate the opportunity. I wish I could stay for the people coming after me, but I think I have a plane to catch. But thank you very much for the time.
You know, we all were in session late, and so we got started about an hour late. So sorry to keep you waiting.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. We'll move on now to the Midwestern Greenhouse Gas Reduction Accord update, and Bill Grant and Mike Robertson will be providing that.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Mike Robertson. I'm environmental policy consultant to the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And Bill and I are going to give you an update on what's been happening with the Midwest Governors Association cap and trade discussion. And it's a little frustrating. I know you're on a short timeline today, and we could spend hours talking about the issues that you've just talked about with Mr. Golden. But we're going to try to stick to what's going on in the process. As I looked around the room today, I was surprised at how many people were here, and I noted that this is the first time this session that the words cap and trade have been on the agenda of any one of your committees. And so we're going to explain why that is. And I'm going to start by talking a little bit about the background of how we got here and what's been happening in the timeline of the process. Bill will talk about some of the substantive issues we're discussing. And then we would be happy to get into any kind of conversation you would like about any of the issues that we're going to raise. There are two other members from Minnesota on the Midwest Governors Association Cap and Trade Advisory Group, Jeff Muffet from 3M and David Sparby from Xcel Energy. And if the group has had, I think, nine meetings in various states, Last June, we had a meeting in Minneapolis, and the next meeting of the group is going to be on May 11th and 12th in Minneapolis. And if you would have attended any one of those meetings, and Senator Solon and Representative Knuth and Senator Anderson have attended some of our meetings, and if you spent a few minutes listening to the discussion, you might think that you are at a convention of plumbers or urologists, because we spend a lot of time talking about leakage. and I don't say that facetiously, because it is a way to express, I think, the heart of the debate and the conversation and the policy decisions that have to be made about this issue. When you were looking at the issue of cap and trade in the 2007 session, you were looking at whether Minnesota should go forward and adopt a cap and trade program on its own. And we at the Minnesota Chamber said, wait a minute, what's the economic impact of that? What happens if we do it here and they don't do it there, and how do we compete in the global economy? In 2008, you considered a regional approach, and that's what we're working on now. And as we sit in these conversations in our regional meetings, we have the same conversation. What's going to happen if we do it within this six-state region of the Midwest, and they don't do it in the rest of the country? And I note that within the last few days in Representative Waxman's committee in Washington, the exact same conversation is occurring. What happens to industrial competition in the United States if they don't do it in other countries? One of the things that I think all of the members, and there are 42 members of this group, this advisory group, I think we have all agreed, and we've discussed many times in our conversations, that there really needs to be a national approach to dealing with this issue. And we agree that there should be a global approach. And hopefully in the coming months we will see that happen, and we've talked a little bit about that earlier today. So we're going to talk about how we got to where we are and why you are not debating a regional cap and trade bill during this session. You may recall, and just to give you a brief history, back in the MCAG process took place in 2007. In November of 2007, the Midwest governors met in Milwaukee, a very big event where they adopted a number of directions that they wanted to head into, and one of them was to develop a model rule for a Midwest state cap-and-trade program, and they wanted that model rule to be brought back to them in November of 2008. They also developed a number of other recommendations. Bill and I are on this group on cap and trade, but there are other advisory groups that are working on energy efficiency. The governors wanted to recommendations back on how to implement the policy to achieve a 2% reduction in energy consumption. Minnesota, you've adopted a 1.5%. And there are other groups that are working on biofuels. There's a proposal, a direction to develop a proposal for a low-carbon fuel standard, which you have begun to debate here in the Minnesota legislature. There are a group working on renewable energy standards. So all of these end up being complementary policies that come into the discussion of how do you put this all together with a cap-and-trade program. So this group has been meeting, and the group that is involved in the cap and trade are not all of the states of the Midwest governors. There are six states involved in this discussion. There are 12 states that are part of the Midwest Governors Association. So they're not all, some of them, there are some additional observer states, but there are six states: Minnesota, Iowa, Wisconsin, Illinois, Michigan, and Kansas. So we have been, and Bill in a moment is going to go through some of the policy issues that we're working on and the various elements of a regional cap and trade. One of the critical factors and the reason for the delay and the reason why we haven't gotten to the point of developing the final recommendations and didn't meet that November 15th, 2008 deadline is because of the modeling work that's going on to assess the impact of a cap and trade program in the region. One of the things that you 1 year ago passed, and I want to in fact just read some of this language because it's very relevant to the discussions that you've had earlier today and that you're going to have in the future, and the concern that I raised about leakage and the impact on consumers and businesses in our state and in our region if we do it and they don't. So we wanted to know the impact. You wanted to know the impact in the legislation that you passed in Chapter 340 a year ago. You said that the Commissioner of Commerce shall arrange with the Midwest Governors Association for a study to be conducted by expert consultants that analyze the economic, environmental, and public health costs and benefits to Minnesota of a cap-and-trade program. The study must consider the impact of a cap-and-trade program on individual industrial sectors subject to the program and on the state economy and consumers, and how expenditures of any auction revenue on the measures identified can reduce the economic costs and increase the economic, environmental, and public health benefits. There's some more very specific language about your concern about the impact on consumers and the impact on business. So there's been a very complex process that's been going on to develop this modeling information. The first part of that modeling is going to be completed very soon. We're going to be seeing it at the May meeting. That part of the modeling will deal with the energy, electrical generation impacts of a cap and trade, where the energy will come from, and how much it would cost if you make this decision to reduce the amount of CO2 emissions then that can occur. The second part of the modeling, and a totally different model will be run, that deals with the macroeconomic impact. Those things about the impact on consumers, the various industrial sectors, and being able to then compare that to what it might be the competitive aspects from not doing it in other locations. There is a slight problem right now with regard to that modeling because the process has run short on funds to do this work. We expressed some very serious concern about that at the meeting that we had last month in Michigan. The governors are working now to find the funds to do that macroeconomic modeling. And we're told that that modeling is likely to go forward and be completed. It is very important for those of us on the group to be able to have that information before us before we express opinions about going forward with a regional cap-and-trade system. So that modeling has not even begun yet, the economic modeling. And the critical importance of this to Minnesota is that the direction you gave the state agency to work with the regional process on the economic modeling for Minnesota, our modeling, the Minnesota modeling, is going to piggyback onto that regional modeling and become and be much more focused and definitive, hopefully, with regard to impacts in Minnesota. You did provide money to do that, and that money is available, and that money will be used to do that modeling. So I don't know the timeline for that. It's going to be probably several months. There is some urgency that's been expressed about the fact that this debate is now beginning in Washington. One of the concerns that the governors have had is that they be able to express a Midwestern viewpoint on the elements of a national cap-and-trade program and want to use the information and the opinions and the recommendations that are being developed in this cap-and-trade advisory group process to inform that congressional debate. That is likely to be the focus of our meeting on May 11th and 12th in Minneapolis to look at the issues that Bill's going to be talking about and putting those in the context of how does this affect us regionally and how would we want to recommend that those issues be addressed in the congressional debate. So I will stop there and let Bill talk about some of the issues. Then we can express some points on some of those or get into any conversation and questioning that you want on those questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bill Grant for the Isaac Walton League, and I appreciate Mike's remarks about how we've gotten to the point we are. I hope all of you have a copy of these preliminary recommendations from the advisory group in your process. I'm going to be referring to it throughout my remarks. And starting with just a bit of an overview, and as Mike mentioned, this was the result of an agreement by Midwestern governors to pursue work on a Midwest cap and trade system. And I'm certainly very appreciative of the fact that Governor Pawlenty was one of the real drivers behind that, along with Governor Doyle from Wisconsin, really moved this process into high gear. As Mike has pointed out, we've encountered, I think, the same kind of difficulties that other jurisdictions have found in working through these issues, that it's a very data-intensive process, and to really understand the impacts, you really need to do the number crunching to be able to tell just what kind of an effect is actually happening. One of the things I want to point out that the modeling work is not covering that I think is critical is the cost of doing nothing. And I think if we were to stack that cost up against some of the costs that I think we're going to be looking at and swallowing hard on probably when we do get the modeling results, I think it's important context for all of these discussions. The advisory group was charged with making recommendations in two areas, one for the establishment of a cap and trade system, but also for where we would actually set the cap at a regional level. The first thing that we got about the business of doing was setting design principles. Thought it was best to agree, if we could, on what the parameters of a system like this should look like and what principles we shouldn't violate in designing the system. And a few of these, I think, are particularly relevant to the conversation that we've had so far today, starting by ensuring that the system is equitable, administratively simple, that we can actually explain it to our grandmothers, and that there's a clear path forward for those that we're regulating to achieve compliance under the program. We want to cover as many sources as practical. We want to bring as much of the economy under the cap as possible. That leads to the most robust market trading environment, and every time that we leave another sector out, the onus on those that are under the cap probably grows larger. Some of these I'm going to skip over in the interest of time, but we want to ensure that to the extent that we are distributing allowances under the program, that the value that we obtain from either auctioning those allowances or distributing them to covered entities, that we're capturing that value back again and actually applying it to the problem that we're trying to solve. That is, that we need cleaner energy sources and we need to invest to be able to do that. We want to enable linkages to systems that are developing elsewhere around the country. As you know, there's the system in New England, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. There is the system that Mr. Golden was referring to, the Western Climate Initiative. And there are systems in place internationally that would make sense for us to link to, again, in the interest of expanding the market area under which we're operating. Obviously, we want to maximize economic and employment opportunities while minimizing the transitional impacts in jobs, energy costs, and so forth. Mike mentioned the leakage issue, and we want to reduce the potential for leakage. And anytime you're dealing with a system that doesn't cover the universe of the system that you're trying to influence, you are going to have leakage issues, and we want to limit those to the extent possible. I mentioned before that we want to stimulate investment, especially in low-carbon technologies. We want to make sure that we give credit for past actions. I know a lot of entities that are probably going to be under the cap particularly in a state like Minnesota, have already taken actions, and we want to make sure that they're properly recognized for those actions. I'm going to talk about offsets in a minute because it's been a very contentious issue at the Midwest Governors Association meetings. But the principle here is that we want to make sure that offsets, and by offsets I mean those credits that are created outside of the capped sectors and sold to the capped entities, that those offsets are real, that they're in addition to what would have happened anyway, that we can verify them, that they're permanent, and that we have a system for enforcing them. We want to make sure that we allow flexibility for participating jurisdictions like Minnesota to adopt the system according to our own needs. And there are several places throughout the document, as I'm going to mention, where we're envisioning that flexibility to the states is the most desirable outcome. Let me turn then to the recommendations themselves. Starting with the target that we're trying to achieve, and the agreed-upon target at this point within the group is that by 2050, we would achieve a 60% to 80% reduction below 2005 levels. That's 2005 being the benchmark year for those reductions. This is in keeping with what we've heard from the scientific community, although it's perhaps at the lower end of what the scientific community is telling us is needed in terms of overall reductions by mid-century. But it was a level that groups around the table felt comfortable aspiring to. In terms of the scope of the program itself and the sectors that would be covered, the electricity sector and the industrial sector were two easy ones. Everyone assumes that those sectors would be covered. The more controversial sectors to cover would be fuel serving residential, commercial, and industrial buildings. And in this sector, we are thinking primarily of natural gas distribution and then transportation fuels and whether to put transportation under the cap or not. The way this issue stands at the moment is that all of these sectors would be under the cap, but with respect to the residential, commercial, industrial sectors and the transportation fuel sector, we are still awaiting modeling results, and I believe these are the results that we're expecting before our May meeting to allow us to reach a definitive agreement on whether to include those sectors or not. The threshold that we're trying to achieve in all of these sectors is an 85 to 95% coverage of the emissions coming from those sectors. So there are going to be de minimis levels of emissions from smaller sources that we wouldn't attempt to try and cover for just administrative simplicity and the fact that at some point those emissions become de minimis. But a goal of getting between 85 and 95%. Mike mentioned complementary policies, and I think everyone around the table assumes that, particularly in the more difficult sectors like the transportation sector, that simply including that sector under the cap is not necessarily going to achieve the emission reductions we expect. Most observers expect that if you cap the transportation sector, what's going to happen is that oil refineries and others are going to purchase credits needed to comply and pass the cost of those credits directly onto their consumers, and that until and unless we have significant new technologies in that sector, we're not going to drive emission reductions other than by increasing the price of the product. Complementary policies like a low-carbon fuel standard and others are intended to complement and go hand-in-hand with the cap-and-trade program to drive additional technology development and reductions in those sectors. I mentioned before the linking issue, and we do want to create linkages to other other programs that are compatible with the ones the one that we're developing. Going on to page 5 under allowances, and this is again another really controversial issue. Not so much that we would how we would create them. I think there's general agreement that for every ton of CO2 or its equivalent, there would be an allowance created. The challenge is how to distribute those allowances. Should those allowances be distributed freely to everyone, just to some? Should those allowances instead be auctioned, as Mr. Golden was referring to? And if so, in what manner? And I would say that where we are with that at this point is kind of a punt. We've indicated that it ought to be up to the individual state jurisdictions to determine whether allowances to covered entities in their states should be auctioned or given away freely. There is some sentiment, though, around the table that this could be problematic, that letting every jurisdiction figure this out on their own could create some unintended consequences. And I think as we continue discussing this, there is more and more interest in a uniform recommendation in this area. But the challenge is that those that expect to be covered by the cap have a very real concern about the cost of allowances under an auction system and are averse to it for that reason. Once, as I mentioned before, though, once we do get around the issue of how we're distributing the allowances, I think there is general agreement about the purposes to which we want to put allowance value, that we want to accelerate transformational investment, we want to mitigate transitional impacts, and we want to address the harmful impacts due to climate change, those things that we're going to have to adapt to whether we like it or not. I'm going to move on to page 9 of your document. And again, I think the point to bear in mind here is that we're still recommending that allowances should be distributed, or decisions about how to distribute allowances should be left to each jurisdiction. But there is agreement about some of the mechanisms that we want to use, specific mechanisms to capture allowance value. One is the creation of a regional low-carbon technology commercialization fund, that any auction revenue or any value captured from allowance distribution would, at least some percentage of that money would go into that type of a fund. And we've gotten quite specific about how such a fund would be established, how it would be coordinated, what things it would focus on. We're looking at the bottom of page 10 at things like carbon capture and storage technologies, advanced biomass conversion technologies, other efficiency measures and grid efficiencies, things like smart grid, combined heat and power projects, storage technologies, particularly in the electricity sector, advanced low-carbon transportation technologies, and the like. You can read the list. While, again, we're struggling with how these allowances might be distributed, and I don't think we're unique in struggling with that question, that's a problem that's come up in similar discussions around the country, and I think you're going to see as a principal bone of contention in the federal debate, we are really coalesced around how some, at least a good portion of that money would be spent. I want to turn your attention next to page 12 of the document, and this, again, is the issue of offsets that I mentioned, and I put offsets under the general rubric of cost containment. By making offsets available from the non-cap sector, you have the potential to drive down the cost of emission allowances in the cap sectors. There are other benefits that come from exploring offsets from the agriculture and forestry sectors primarily. There are a number of co-benefits that come with many of the terrestrial sequestration activities that we would expect to see develop under an offset program in both the agriculture and forestry sectors. And obviously, with those two sectors being very important to Minnesota's economy, making sure that there is a provision for offsets and how we do that is very important. But within that, of course, as I mentioned before, are the real and difficult issues associated with how do you make sure that these offsets are really accomplishing the same thing in terms of emission reductions that putting a piece of equipment on an industrial plant to reduce emissions, that those two activities are achieving the same end in terms of reducing a ton of a CO2 or the equivalent thereof. One of the concerns, I think, around this is how elaborate a system needs to be put in place to devise an offset system to monitor it over time to make sure that the offsets that are being generated are real, that they really do represent activities that would not have taken place otherwise. That's what's meant by the term additional, that they're verifiable, and that we have a system in place for doing that and for enforcing that, all of that. So still a contentious issue, but one that I think we're making progress on. Last thing I'd say about offsets on page 15, which is a very important one, are the limits on the use of offsets under the program. In other words, what percentage of a covered entity's compliance obligations ought to be able to be met by offsets. There are some who are suggesting that 100% of a covered entity's commitments should be able to be met by offsets. There are those of us on the committee that are concerned that doing so really exempts those covered entities from having to make investments themselves in emission reduction technologies, and that we would prefer to limit that ability and perhaps over time even drive down the level at which offsets can be used. The recommendation at this point, but which has not been finalized, is to limit offset use to somewhere between 15 and 50% of a covered entity's compliance obligation. It's also the issue of how offset should be limited geographically. In other words, should all of the offsets come from within the region bounded by the six states covered by the Midwest cap and trade system, or should we allow offsets to come in from other parts of the country or even other parts of the world? Obviously, the benefit of bringing in offsets from elsewhere is that they may be lower cost and they could reduce the cost of our system. The downside is that it doesn't drive innovation and emission reductions within the Midwest, and that for a lot of us was the purpose of creating this system in the first place. I'm not going to go through the rest of this. I'd be happy to answer questions on how we set up an emissions reporting system, how we deal with compliance and enforcement and program implementation issues, other than to say under program implementation that the target date for implementation at this point is January 1st, 2012. And I wanted to close just by reminding you of kind of the schedule as we see it going out from here. Mike reminded you of some of this, but we are now hoping that the May meeting will be, if not our last meeting, our next to last meeting. And once those recommendations have been forwarded to the governors, The expectation is that the governors, along with the consultants that the group has been using all along, will develop a model rule for consideration by the various states, and that would be coming back sometime this fall in time for you to be able to consider adoption of the model rule at the state level here during your next legislative session. Remember that the legislation the Global Warming Solutions Act that you passed last year requires legislative action to adopt whatever comes out of the Midwest Greenhouse Gas Accord. So barring federal action that would supersede all of this by then, this will be an issue we think that's going to be teed up for your consideration next January, February. One other point that I wanted to remind you of, and I know for those of you who are involved in the final negotiations of the Next Generation Energy Act, I don't need to remind you of this, but there's also the little issue of a moratorium on new fossil fuel plants construction that goes into effect this August in the absence of the state having either adopted its own cap and trade system or the equivalent or signing on to a regional system of some kind. It appears highly likely at this point that such a moratorium will go into effect on August 1st. So, and there may very well be issues that you will need to deal with next year in that regard as well. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions, as I'm sure Mike would.
So Mr. Grant and Mr. Robertson, it appears that the energy of the committee has gone into setting up the parameters or the principles around which the cap and trade will operate, and that you need I'm not sure. You have to set up a modeling program that shows you what would be the implications or the impact of each of those parameters, and then the committee will decide what their recommendation will be?
Madam Chair, the direction from the governors in November of 2007 was develop a model rule to implement a regional cap-and-trade program. The advisory committee is developing the elements of a regional cap-and-trade program. That does not mean that all of the members of the advisory committee will be supporting the implementation of a regional cap-and-trade program. And there are some questions that arise that will be resolved by looking at some of the modeling data in terms of what specific decisions are made about the elements of that Bill just went through. But I don't expect that. I mean, this is a preliminary recommendation from the group. We're going to be talking about the federal aspects or what we could recommend that the governors take to the federal level in addressing these issues. I'm sure there will be discussion at the end of the process about how the members of the group view the recommendations in terms of whether they should actually be implemented or not, which is the whole debate that if this comes back to you next year, that you will be having as well.
And Madam Chair, if I could add to that, we have begun seeing some of the modeling results already, and I think they've been very helpful in our deliberations. As far as, there may be different perspectives around the table about the value of the work that's been done here. In addition to providing an opportunity that I think this creates to help influence the federal debate, I think it also, by maintaining that we are going to implement the system, puts pressure, continuing pressure, on our federal representatives to act, and that in the absence of sound federal policy or any federal policy, we are going to move forward with implementation. And that was the agreement that was reached in 2007. Now, will there be complete and unanimous consensus that every aspect of the system that we've recommended should go forward as proposed here? No, there will not be, and that will be the subject of vigorous debate here and in the other states, I'm quite sure.
But when you present a completed model rule to each of the states, and they still will have to write their own program. Will they be consistent? I mean, they will follow the same principles, but they won't necessarily be the same.
That's the next question of how this actually becomes law and how these states join together to implement this. This is not a proposal for a state compact where you have to have the exact words in each state and it has to be approved by the Congress. The REGI states, the eastern states, did this basically through agreements with the governors and memorandums of understanding. You made a decision that this has to be approved by the legislature. The other states, I would assume that this would be occurring in the other states as well. So we haven't spent a lot of time talking about the politics of how you accomplish these actions in each state, do they remain the same enough so that you can have a regional system and implement a regional system. There's recommendations in here for developing an agreement between the states on how to implement this once it takes effect in some way. But there's a lot of questions about how it would take effect, when it would take effect. We've just raised the issue of how many states would it take to become effective. There are six states and one Canadian province that are in this conversation. Should it be effective when there are three states or four states or all of the states? Those are some very unresolved issues right now.
And was there a reason why you didn't come up with a plan? I mean, I'm not criticizing what you're doing at all. I know it's been very tedious work, and I'm just wondering if it was ever considered that you would come up with a plan that would cover all the states, and they they'd have to buy in or buy out.
We were given directions that we were not to develop a compact kind of proposal because that would require congressional approval. So it's whatever legal mechanism short of that the states determine, and I'm assuming that it's going to require legislative action, most likely in all of the states.
But is it going to require, what happens if, is there the potential for the states to have more stringent requirements in some states than in other states, and will it be able to work effectively that way?
Madam Chair, I think that there are areas that we envision within these guidelines that states would have flexibility to act, and one of those would be whether or not a state could set a more stringent target and timeline than the other states, and I believe the answer to that question is yes. Another issue, as I mentioned, was a distribution of allowances, and how that would occur might be somewhat different from state to state. There are other aspects of this, though, that I think do need to be uniform. For example, what qualifies as an offset ought to be the same in every state. Otherwise, there are going to be these perverse outcomes where everyone rushes to one state to sell their offsets and nothing happens in the others. So I think that the general principle here is that what we'd like to see out of the model rule adoption process is as much of an agreement to adopt the model rule as written, rather than tinkering with it state by state so that we are then faced with the problem of bringing it all back and saying, do we still have a system that hangs together as one uniform system?
Yeah, I would be concerned about inequities between states.
Madam Chair, could I just make a comment? We've used this term, the model rule. Our advisory group has not been working on the model rule. We've been working on these broader elements of a program. The governor's staff established a subgroup about midway through the process that is made up, I think, all entirely of staff people from the various states that have begun to develop this model rule. This is kind of the question of the issue of the devil being in the details, because that would be the details part of this, and we have not seen that any draft of that at this point, so we don't know what issues may come up as we look at the drafts of the details of the model rule.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Senator Jungbar and then Senator
Thank Dole. You, Madam Chair, and to either Mr. Robertson or Mr. Grant. And whether I agree with, you know, some of this or not, as we move forward on things, I still want to make sure we always have the best product. So I try to work hard to make sure that. And I think you did a good job in coming out with principles, preliminary recommendations, that kind of thing. But they seem, you know, overly broad. And Mr. Golden talked about keeping things kind of clean and simple. And if we put something like this together, for example, and maybe you even agree with me, but I don't think we ought to have offsets if we put it together because of the problems with cheating the system, if you will, or inconsistencies and things. But is that kind of the next step? Are we going to hone this down? Are we going to see something cleaner, simpler, and something that's more visible so that there's less chance for all these different types of implementations?
Well, Senator Jungbar, you know, when you look at the latest draft of climate legislation at the federal level, it runs to 650 pages. And even that, I would say, is not at the level of detail, at least with respect to the cap and trade portion of that bill, that you would have to have in order to be able to implement the program. It is a complex policy mechanism, and there's no denying that. I think, as Mike explained, the thought is that the next step here in this process is the creation of this model rule, which would define with specificity the details of how you would actually implement a system like this, relying on the agreements that were reached here and the principles, the overriding principles that we've come to.
And, Madam Chair, just to finish that up, I didn't mean by clean and simple, I didn't mean it necessarily was going to be short, but that we would be more specific on which items we were going to pick and choose. And because I think in the recommendations, it is so broad and there's so many choices that I think it would be hard to get any kind of consistency across the states that would be involved. So I do understand it would take a great level of detail.
It is a real challenge, and as Mike points out, the fact that we're not operating under an anticipated compact of the states that would really drive uniformity. The state representatives to this group have cautioned us time and again that there are going to be issues of state jurisdiction that states are going to want to invoke, and that there's nothing that we can do here that could preempt that. So that has been a challenge.
Thank you.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to... for clarification, you had said earlier, Mr. Grant, that this modeling is not going to have like a baseline component of if we did nothing, you know. So is it the modeling, once it's done, is it just going to be a matter of picking between what's those results and then implementing a system based on those results, or is there still the opportunity to say, well, we don't like any of the options, and we're not going to do any of these things. We're just going to keep things as it is. Is that still an option?
Madam Chair and Senator Dahl, I'll say for the work group itself, that's not really an option because we were given a charge to come up with these recommendations. Is that an option for the states that are signatories to this agreement? Of course. So I think the modeling results are going to, I think, be an important point along the way here to whether or not governors in the various states feel that this is something that they can sign on to or not.
And, Madam Chair, if I might just want to follow up, then my concern is not having that baseline in there. If we still have this option to not do anything, we don't have anything really to compare with. I mean, it's a matter of, you know, that whatever options that come forward are going to be very expensive and they're going to be complicated. And it's, you know, it's easier to say, no, we're not going to do anything because we don't have anything to base off what if we don't do anything, what's going to occur.
Mr. Robertson.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, to clarify one point, there is a reference case in the modeling, and the reference case is what we expect will occur without any action. So this modeling is being done not for the period up to 2050 because the modelers determined there were so many uncertainties about going that far out. So it's a 20-year period taking us to 2030, and it will be based upon a 2005 reference case where assumptions have been made and then projected out as to what will happen in the energy consumption if we don't do anything.
Well, and just to further clarify that, though, what I meant by we won't know the cost of doing nothing, yeah, we have some sense of where a business as usual case will take us if we don't act in terms of where our energy consumption will be and resulting emissions. What we haven't modeled are the impacts of those emissions and the costs that fall to society from failing to curb those emissions.
Okay. Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a few comments about the modeling and just cautioning to put all of our eggs in the modeling basket. I think it's important, it's useful, and I'm glad that we have the Midwestern Governors Association doing it as opposed to the Partners Affordable Energy, or Lignite Coal Council and their allies, for example, and trying to have some assumptions in there that not everyone was at the table to have their input into. And there are, I think, a lot of stakeholders at the table. I think the most diverse group we've had, but there's still a few that aren't, in particular low-income representatives, and we talk about the impacts. They haven't really been at the table in this discussion, but we are still, as policymakers, our job is to take this information and make a values judgment, and we have a group of stakeholders that will do that, but ultimately that's our job. And I think it's useful to have this modeling information. I'm glad we're having it. I'm glad it's a diverse group doing it. But we ultimately have to do the heavy lifting of deciding what's the right thing for our state with these inputs. And so I hope that the advisory group members will do some of that. I don't, frankly, having been to a lot of these meetings, seeing them able to do all of that, because they're not there representing the people. They're there representing specific interests in different sectors and that are never going to probably come to an agreement. Our job is to represent the people as legislators and elected leaders. So I appreciate the comments, and I just hope you'll do some of that heavy lifting of the values judgment eventually, but I think that's ultimately what we're going to have to do.
Although I would say, Representative Knuth, that it would be very hard for us to implement our own system in a vacuum, and it needs to be on a regional basis, and so there needs to be some uniformity across the states. Other questions or comments? Well, then, thank you, gentlemen, for the report. Thank you for your commitment to the process. I know it's been a long process, and we look forward to seeing your completed product.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And we also have a report on cap and trade governance options. And Steve Kelly is here from the Humphrey Institute.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. I'm Steve Kelly. I'm the director of the Center for Science, Technology, and Public Policy, which is based at the Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity for the center to conduct the research on governance options for cap and trade. We appreciate the opportunity to assist the legislature with respect to these policy questions that occur at the intersection of science and policy. I am here really to introduce the research team that the center recruited because they are the experts on this subject now. And I will turn it over to Bonnie Keeler, who was the project director for the work. and let the team explain the findings to you.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Keeler.
Madam Chair and members, thanks very much for the opportunity to share the research that we've done on this project. And before we begin, I just wanted to clarify a little bit about the scope and goals of this particular study, as it's very different from the research and studies that you've heard earlier on in this session. So this was, again, a study that was funded under the Green Solutions Act of 2008. So this was not looking at the science of climate change, nor was it looking at cap and trade alternatives or policy alternatives, nor was it looking at specific ways in which cap-and-trade revenue could be spent. This was a forward-looking perspective by the legislature, recognizing that cap-and-trade, in whatever form it takes in the state of Minnesota, is going to bring with it a lot of complex governance issues, questions about who should have the authority to make these kinds of decisions, the roles of a lot of key groups, the legislature, state agencies, technical experts, and citizens, and what role they should play in making some of these important policy decisions. And then also an evaluation of existing structures and models and processes, both within the state of Minnesota and regionally and internationally, that might serve as good governance models as we move forward and try and address some of these really complex policy decisions that relate to cap-and-trade governance and carbon emissions. So just to clarify that our study is going to focus specifically on the governance implications of cap-and-trade, and that was what our research was focusing on. So in order to address this challenge of trying to figure out what sort of key considerations we could recommend in terms of how to the governance issues, complex governance issues that are associated with cap and trade, we brought in a huge group of stakeholders and contributors to this project, different participants, both from state agencies within the state of Minnesota. So we had representatives from over a dozen state agencies come contributing their thoughts and insights on governance and specifically on cap and trade and how it might affect them and what they perceive their role in the making decisions about cap and trade. We also brought in stakeholders from across the spectrum, from advocacy to the private sector, industry, and held four different stakeholder meetings where we had a lot of conversations, not only about cap and trade and its implications, but also about how governance processes should function. What are some of the key criteria that make certain governance processes effective or not effective? We evaluated a lot of existing processes and structures within the state of Minnesota. So we took a careful look at the Legislative Commission on Joint Citizen Legislative Commission on Minnesota Resources, for example, as a model of joint legislative and citizen participation, and looked at that as a potential model and trying to figure out if citizen participation or joint legislative citizen participation models like that have a place in making some of these key decisions about how we handle cap and trade legislation in the state. So I just want to reiterate what's been clear, I think, from the previous presentations, and that is that there's a lot of complexities to cap and trade that are going to make this a really interesting governance challenge. And that is that we have the potential. So our specific focus was looking at the revenue that could be generated by a cap and trade bill. So there are basically two assumptions that we made going forward. One, the first assumption was that there will be some kind of cap and trade program eventually in the state of Minnesota. We didn't make any recommendations about the form of that policy or how it should play out, but that there would be some kind of cap and trade program. And that this cap and trade program, whether through the sale of allowances, would generate some amount of revenue for the state of Minnesota. So with the assumption that there would be cap and trade and it would generate revenue, we look at the complex governance issues associated with figuring out how to spend that revenue, regardless of how it was spent, if it was distributed back to consumers in form of rebates, if it was invested in energy efficiency or green jobs programs. So recognizing that this policy is one that has not yet been formed or adopted, and there's a lot of important decisions yet to be made about this issue, we wanted to be forward-looking and think about anticipating some of the challenges that are going to be coming into play when we think about how to make these decisions about revenue. And then the last thing that I wanted to touch on before Luke and Linda give you some of the details about our findings is that this report that you have in front of you, we think serves as a valuable resource, not just for cap and trade specific governance issues, but also for thinking about the governance process in general, especially when you're making any kind of revenue allocation decisions. So because we brought in so many different perspectives and had a lot of really interesting discussions about governance and what makes for effective governance, we think that this report contains some important insights that apply to a variety of different policy challenges. So a couple things that I wanted to point you towards that might be of interest, especially to the cap and trade discussion, is that we've spoken a lot about the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which is the existing regional model for cap and trade legislation in the U.S., and that's Northeastern and Mid-Atlantic states. So we took a close look at the REGI program and how all of the different states have decided to proceed with in terms of governance of the revenue that they're generating under that their programs. And so there's a table in the back of the report starting on page 32, going through 34, that has each of the 10 states that participate in the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, the policy goals, some of the ways in which revenue is being spent in those states, how they're being funded, and how the governance process is working in each of those states. So that's an interesting reference that you can turn back to as you're thinking about how Minnesota decides to handle these challenges. And then finally, the other piece that applies to a lot of different policy issues is we spent a lot of time thinking about the appropriate role of non-governmental citizens and technical experts in making important decisions about policy. And so the role of citizen participation in governance was also something that we spent a lot of time investigating. And so there's a table in the back of the report on page 36 that compares a variety of different citizen participation mechanisms and the pros and cons of them and how they have been applied to other natural resource management situations. And then also there's a discussion, I think, on page 5 that talks, there's a table about advantages and disadvantages of public participation and in discussion of those, which is something we won't have time to get into today, but I wanted to just let you know that it does exist in this report because it's a valuable and interesting topic, I think, that applies to a lot of governance situations. So I'm going to turn it over to Linda Way, and she's going to talk a little bit about some of the key findings from our report.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. To address some of the complexities of the governance issues, we really divided the way we approached it into four distinct phases to separate some of the functional layers. We recognize the different roles that the legislature, state agencies, technical experts, and the public can play in each of these different levels. We believe there's a delegation of power and authority when looking at this through these four different lenses and a balance between accountability and representation. So in looking at the first stage, prioritization and allocation in funds, which we saw as the establishment of overall goals, this was the prioritization of public values versus actual dollar allocations. We believe that there were two different roles that could be played, decision makers and advisors, and we saw the legislature and the public playing active roles in both of these parts. In terms of revisiting the decisions, we saw that as an important key component in this phase, as changing conditions will warrant this. But this has to be balanced with stability and predictability. In some of our stakeholder meetings, we discovered that 2 years might be too short of a time to do that, and 6 years might be more appropriate, although haven't prescribed specific dates. In terms of public participation and geographic representation, we saw this as being key because citizens' engagement, education, and innovative policy is essential. The public's involvement in this process is essential to these components, as well as allowing for geographic equity. In the second phase, administration, which we saw as collecting and analyzing program data, monitoring fiscal operations and coordinating programs, as well as providing feedback to the legislature. We looked at two different roles that the state agency or a trust could have in this. We looked at the state agency in terms of a new state agency or an existing state agency. when appropriate, we saw that an existing state agency should play that role, but it really does is determined by the allocation of funds. In terms of a trust, there was a look at allowing a trust, a separate nonprofit trust or some sort of trust, to play this administrative role to allow for greater citizen representation. However, that has to be balanced with the concern that this what we're talking about is a significant amount of money. It can range up in, toward the billions of dollars. And so entrusting a nonprofit that isn't accountable to the public is of concern. The third phase, program-level funding decision, is where funding decisions about specific programs are actually made. And within this, there would have to be some consideration in how these proposals would be considered. Would it be an RFP process, open, closed, through invitation, or et cetera? Because of the scientific nature of this, of the decisions that need to be made, we really recommend that technical expertise be highlighted here, that there be some form of technical experts in this stage. The fourth stage, oversight, was something that stakeholders saw as essential. They saw the need to institutionalize oversight and accountability. Oversight is something we define as being financial auditing and program evaluation. And in order for this to be effective, it really does have to be nonpartisan and objective. So this is the four layers, the stages that we've laid out. Luke Hollenkamp will talk more about these four stages and one application of that in the following model.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Mr. Hollenkamp.
First, I'd like to direct your attention to page 40 in your packets. This will be very helpful to follow along on, as well as you'll be seeing the same information being provided up on the screen. Also, if you're following along in one of the handouts, it's the third slide in the handout. As an example of revenue governance, I'm going to talk briefly about our fourth model. We've outlined four total models in the back of our report that show different features of revenue governance. However, we feel that this particular model, which we've called Legislative Sunset and Regional Councils, is very illustrative of unique elements that can be incorporated into any revenue governance model system. Again, we don't necessarily recommend or endorse this particular model, but I think it has many special components that have been tied together that are very informative in this case. Particularly, this model shows funding priorities that are reevaluated over the long term, not annual or biannual basis. It also incorporates equitable geographic representation in terms of regional councils, and we've also formed into it the option for direct consumer rebates. In the first phase of governance, again, which we are calling prioritization and allocation of funds, what we see here is that that policy goals and expenditure categories are decided by the legislature in consultation with the governor. The legislation that establishes these expenditures will sunset after 6 years, which balances the goals of funding stability with periodic review. And again, we've had some feedback saying that 6 years seems to be an appropriate length of time. However, of course, that is open to many different types of discussion. Next, we have administration. Once these revenue expenditure categories are determined, the funds then go to different organizations within the state government. You can see that each expenditure category is administered by a separate agency. In the case of this particular situation, what we're showing here is that first you may have the option of distributing consumer rebates by way of check. If you do such an option, that would generally go through the Department of Revenue. And in this case, program-level funding decisions are not necessarily needing to be made by the Department of Revenue, since often checks will just flow directly through them without any other conversation being needed. If, for instance, then a portion of those funds were allocated to public infrastructure projects that may affect the state as a whole, or very large items that affect most of the population of the state in its entirety, those particular program-level funding decisions would go through many of the different state agencies as well as the Department of Administration. Also, you may have a statewide planning commission that coordinates all those activities
within the Department of Administration. Some of the goals of revenue expenditure then may need to be determined more at a local or regional level. In that case, we would see multiple regional councils that are formed across the state. This is very much framed after what you might see in the State Arts Board configuration, with regional councils representing different geographic interests across the state. This also incorporates a high level of citizen engagement on the very localized level, which means that all state citizens have the ability to be involved in this process in some way, shape, or form without having to come down to the Twin Cities or capital. Then finally, a level of oversight obviously is needed over these funds. As Linda mentioned, it could be a very substantial sum of money. What we would most likely see in this situation is that a state oversight board would be distributing funds to the regional councils and then would oversee those councils and what their particular decisions are in that situation. So they would have given the authority to spend those funds over to the councils, but then they would also expect a certain level of reporting back to that higher level state organization. Additionally, then, more of the state level activities that are being performed by a statewide planning commission or the Department of Revenue would be overseen and evaluated, evaluated with oversight by the Office of Legislative Auditor as well as Minnesota Management and Budget. A couple of things that we see here, again, drawing your attention to a few unique elements to this particular model, is that there is still a major role for the legislature and governor in setting spending priorities and expenditure categories. But their role is more limited to once every 6 years or whatever that time period may be determined to be. One of the advantages to this is it provides a predictable level of funding over an extended period of time, which allows for increased investment in multi-year projects. However, a disadvantage of it is that, that the legislature and the governor are less likely and less able to respond to emergencies, market changes, and advancement in technologies that might occur over that six-year period. The model also illustrates the importance of considering public policy goals and funding priorities in determining the nature of representation at each of the different levels of government. For instance, the state agencies and legislators and statewide commission are entities that that emphasize statewide representation. However, decisions at the local level that affect local communities are often made best by decision makers in those local communities that understand those particular situations, especially when you look at major metropolitan area compared to outstate Minnesota. This promotes a level of geographic equity and representation that are definitely enhanced in this process. Also, there's a greater level of deliberation, openness, and efficiency when the regional decision makers are controlling funding that directly affect their neighbors and constituents. Also, you see that locally based governance has the added benefit of the awareness and perhaps the greater support of the local community, since they can more directly impact and feel the effects of any governance expenditures that are occurring in this state. Again, that's one of the examples of the four models. We encourage you to take a look at some of the other models there for different components that when you consider any legislation in the future can provide building blocks for what might be your ultimate system for revenue governance. What we're showing here is a slide with the stakeholder participants that came to our four meetings. And in fact, many of these, the representatives from these organizations were here today. So we'd like to thank everybody that was involved in those stakeholder work, as well as there's many individuals that we consulted with regionally, internationally, as well as locally within state level that provided a lot of good in-depth information to our report. Also, an electronic copy of our report can be found at the website listed on the slides there, as well as at the you can go directly to the Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs website, which has a link for the center, which also has the report directly on that. I thank you very much for your time, and we hope that this report is very informative to you, and we welcome any comments or questions.
So am I to assume that the fourth model is your favorite model?
No, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm sure that you recognize the challenge of this task, especially in light of the fact that we're without an existing model rule or even existing priorities in how revenue should be spent and trying to make recommendations about what the best policy considerations or what the best governance model is moving forward. So this... In some ways, this is a little premature to recommend a specific prescription for how these decisions should be made when we're still unclear about what the exact goals of the program is, the scope that it's going to cover, and some of the specific policies that are going to come out of this. So what we're hoping to do is provide some considerations, some framework, and some food for thought about different creative ways, innovative ways that you might want to explore the concept of thinking broadly about governance in a really complex issue like cap and trade. So we highlighted this model specifically because it had a combined variety of different elements that were brought up in stakeholder conversations, but not necessarily as an endorsed model.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions or comments? Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I just want to say thank you for this report. I actually think it'll be useful as we look at all kinds of, we're always trying to figure out ways to set up governance entities, advisory committees, trying to figure out how much to delegate, how much to involve citizens, how much to wrap in state agencies, et cetera. So, I think I'll just keep this around for use, not just on this issue, but on a wide array of those efforts that we embark on and always have to pass through Senator Rest's committee so we'll have some rationale that we can point to why we picked this model and not that model.
And this will come in very handy when we do have a model that we are following. Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just want to echo, I know I was interviewed by a few of you at the beginning of this since I carried the bill that had this study in it. And I said, frankly, a lot of what I want out of this is how do we protect the money to make sure that we have that buy-in if we, we have the cap and trade and significant revenue, and how do we make sure there's buy-in that it's invested in the right things and in the right ways. And I think you did that and went beyond that, so I appreciate the work you did.
Thank you. Representative Brainerd.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I, too, would like to thank you for your work, and I also think that we're challenged now, Mike Robertson mentioned earlier that we haven't been talking cap and trade this session, and I think in the interim, we have some responsibility as legislators to come up to speed with the work that's been done while we haven't been talking cap and trade. The reports that have been presented to us tonight the movement at the national level, I think, warrants some homework on our part. So I'm looking forward to some interim work, and maybe some or all of you could be part of helping bring us up to speed, and I'd appreciate that.
Thank you. Anything further? Then thank you for your presentation and for the hard work that went into the report and providing it for us.
Thank you.
That brings us to the end of our agenda, and I don't foresee another meeting this session for the Energy Committee. But there's always a chance that something will come up that we need to take up. But nothing is scheduled at this time. Representative Hilty, anything for you?
We always hold open the possibility for further meetings. There are some things that would be nice to discuss if we had the opportunity, but we don't have anything further scheduled at this time either.
Okay. Thank you. Meeting adjourned.